You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
A lot of people paint these conspiracies about the JFK assassination that are remarkably complex, and it's like you have all sorts of people tripping over one another plotting to kill JFK. I don't think that was a big conspiracy at all. I keep saying this because I really think it's very simple and yet very profound. The people who were involved in the conspiracy, they weren't one big happy family. They were one small happy family. And as I document in the book, it really took only a handful of people to set the conspiracy in motion.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, the late Michael Collins Piper. Today's show, the missing link in the JFK assassination. Michael Collins Piper was a prolific author, researcher, and journalist. He wrote articles for the American Free Press since its inception in 2001. Prior to that, he wrote for the Spotlight for over 20 years. From the biographical summary from the sixth edition of his most well-known book, Final Judgment, published in 2015, quote, 20 years before the major media discovered the neoconservative cabal that pushed America into the Iraq War, Piper was reporting on their intrigues. In 2004, in The High Priests of War, he assembled a fascinating overview of their insidious record, the first book ever published on the subject. In his provocative 2005 work, The New Jerusalem, Piper confronted the controversial issue of Zionist power in America, a detailed exposition unlike any ever assembled by a modern author, end quote. The following is a presentation on his most well-known book, Final Judgment, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination Conspiracy, that was given after the publication of the third edition and was posted on the internet in 2012. Michael Collins Piper.
Now, how many here have actually read Final Judgment? Okay. How many here have seen the movie JFK? Okay, that's a good starting point. Anytime I start off talking about the book, I like to get a handle on what people know about Kennedy assassination, because like I was telling somebody earlier today, I'm not a Kennedy assassination buff. I never have been. If anything, I'll tell you what, I'm a man ahead of my time. When I was in college, I won a book collector's contest with my books about sinking the Titanic. And if I'd have been smart, I would have figured out a way to make millions of dollars on it, like making a movie about it that's now the hit thing for all time. So, unfortunately, I have areas of interest like that. I'm not one of these JFK enthusiasts or anything like that. I read virtually all the mainstream books on the subject. You know, I never had any real strong views about it one way or another. So you can't paint me in that corner. Now, you can, I suppose, paint me in the corner of being a quote-unquote right-wing lunatic or right-wing nut, because I work for the Spotlight. But there's a little bit of a problem there. Because of the fact that I do work for the Spotlight, I have a certain independence in writing about the JFK assassination that a lot of people don't have, because the Spotlight has already been so thoroughly targeted and smeared. It's anti-Semitic, it's Holocaust denial, all this and that. We've all heard it. You know all the stories. So anything I write is automatically suspect anyway. So I really am probably one of the few people in the country who could, if in fact the Israeli Mossad did kill John F. Kennedy, as I believe they did, or they played a part in the conspiracy, I should say, I'm probably the only person in the country who has the luxury of being able to write a book on the subject and then still get up in the morning and go to my job and know that I won't be fired for writing the book. So there's a lot of other people who have looked into the JFK assassination who know precisely what I have talked about in the book. They know it's true, but they won't touch it with a 10-foot pole, because these people don't work for an independent newspaper like the Spotlight. Some of these people, you know, One guy is he was a college professor down in Texas. There's a couple people who are newspaper men, or they're, you know, computer analysts or something. They work for organizations and companies that, if they wrote a book and they told everything they knew, their company would get a phone call from, dare I say it, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, and the ADL would say, you know, one of your employees is saying that the Mossad was involved in the Kennedy assassination, and your customers wouldn't like that. So you see, there's where my independence comes in. I have the luxury of being able to say this. Am I right? I don't know. I could be wrong, but the bottom line of it, I don't think that I am, frankly, but the bottom line of it is, all the information that I have put together in the perception of those who have read the book, and that includes people who have read all the other books on the subject, the most common response that I get is, they say, I've read all the other books in the subject. Yours is the only one that ties it all together. And, you know, on the back of the book, there's some advertising copy, some promotional copy of the third edition. It says, once you've read this book, you'll never look at the JFK assassination in the same way again. And that's my personal guarantee to anybody who does read the book. Now, you know, I put a lot of interesting things here together. I normally don't speak with notes. But, you know, I've been subjected to so much abuse by the Anti-Defamation League and the Israeli lobby for things that I have said and for things that I haven't said, that I thought I'd take an opportunity to speak before this audience about some of the things that they're just doing in general that I don't like. And it's because of the fact that I don't like what they're doing that I decided I was going to come out here to California. Because if I've reached more people, you know, people who read my book. They've read the book. They either like it or they don't. The people who don't like it are not able to come back at me and say what's wrong with it. All they say is, oh, it's awful. He's a Holocaust denier. Well, I told somebody the other day, I told the Los Angeles Times this, in fact, you know, first of all, my book is not about the Holocaust. Even if it was about the Holocaust, even if I did deny the Holocaust, what my views are on the Holocaust are or are not have absolutely nothing to do with my book. And this guy from the Los Angeles Times says to me, he says, well, what are your views on the Holocaust? You know what I told him? I really don't care about the Holocaust. It's boring. Enough already. It happened 15 years before I was born. My father and three of his brothers were in the U.S. military, which means they were involved in Holocaust rescue activities. So I don't feel guilty about the Holocaust. I wrote a book about the JFK assassination, so let's talk about it. And you know, they really don't like me to talk that way. Because at the very least, they want me to argue with them and say, well, you know, there were no Jews gassed here, or, you know, there were 5 million who died, not 6 million. I'm not going to get into that debate because I'm not a scholar on the subject. There's anybody wants to know about the Holocaust, I can give them some very good sources on both sides, and they can read it for themselves. I wrote about the JFK assassination. So what do I do when poor old Steve Frog invites me down to Orange County? They don't say his book is wrong. They say, no, he's a Holocaust denier. Now, why do they change the focus? They obviously change the focus for a reason, because they don't want people to look at that book. And I think it's hilarious. The very week that this happened, when they kicked up such a fuss, that was Banned Books Week, sponsored by the National Library Association. Now, I kind of find some irony there. I don't know if the ADL does. I don't think they do. I don't credit the ADL with thinking like normal human beings, because the people who constitute that organization, it is a criminal organization. They're not like we are. They're not like anybody else, for that matter. But like I say, I obviously have said some things that they don't like, and it must be on point. But now here's what's really interesting. I'm going to read you a quote from the ADL. Now, they have attacked final judgment, as you all know. But what was very interesting, what was very, very interesting was that when this eruption broke out down in Orange County, they had to adopt a new position on the JFK assassination. The ADL was saying, oh, well, there are a lot of responsible conspiracy theorists. This is the first time I ever heard the ADL say that conspiracy theories were responsible. They actually said that, well, there are a lot of mainstream conspiracy theorists who could have been invited rather than Mr. Piper. That's what they said to the public. Okay? In other words, well, Mr. Piper's not mainstream, but some conspiracy theorists are. So don't invite him. Well, here is what Abe Foxman, the head of the ADL, said several years ago before he knew I was going to be invited to Orange County. This is very interesting. If segments of the population are really willing to believe that President Kennedy was killed by the military-industrial complex because he was too soft on communism, or that a secret group of Bavarian Freemasons has controlled the secular left for more than 200 years, then it is not hard to imagine some of these same people falling for the lies of Bradley Smith. I think a lot of you know who Bradley Smith is, or the fabrications of Louis Farrakhan and Leonard Jeffries. All of these conspiracy theories share the core feature that the quote-unquote research, which supports them, little more, in fact, than a compendium of anecdotes divorced from their original context, that's a mouthful, is rigged to arrive at predetermined conclusions, not historical revelations or insights. Now, that is a mouthful, but what they're saying is that even if you believe that the military-industrial complex, whatever the military-industrial complex is, if you believe that they were involved in the JFK assassination, then you believe something that you shouldn't believe. That's what they say in some crazy book. It's not crazy to them, though, but Anti-Semitism in America, Outspoken Experts Explode the Myths, a book that only a Semite or an anti-Semite, I suppose, would read, not a normal human being. Needless to say, this was their in-house party line before my book got out to the public. Then when my book got out to the public, of course, they changed their tune and decided that, well, or at least they told the public this, well, it's okay to believe in conspiracy theories, but God forbid you should believe in the one that Mike Piper is promoting. Now, that's kind of interesting. You know, I understand why they want to keep it quiet. I mean, if you look at it, if they did it, and I believe they did it, then they got to keep that quiet because, you know, there's a big thing here. I would say that probably any of you in here who were voting in 1960, you probably didn't vote for John F. Kennedy, unless your views changed. And I know as a child, I used to get involved in arguments with my father because I used to say things like, well, I'm glad they shot Kennedy. I knew that would press his button and he'd get mad. Well, I'm not glad they shot John Kennedy. I'm not glad that anybody gets shot. But that's what I used to say to my father. But the thing about it is, I could have never imagined the things that I know about John F. Kennedy today to be true at one time, nor would I have ever thought that I would have written a book saying, hey, well, Kennedy wasn't such a bad guy after all. And that isn't really what I say in the book. I do say that John F. Kennedy cut deals with the mob. He cut deals with the Israeli lobby. You know, he cut a lot of deals to get elected president. And then when he didn't exactly follow through on his deals, particularly in the realm of his deals with Israel, he got assassinated.
You're listening to researcher and author Michael Collins Piper. Today's show, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, where do you find the Israeli connection? Okay, first of all, let me give you the motive. And you have to read the book to get the full picture. But I'm trying to break this down because it's a very complicated thing. The bottom line of it is, the bottom line motive for Israeli involvement is the fact that John F. Kennedy was trying to stop Israel from building the nuclear bomb. That was probably, according to all the sources, they're not right-wing sources. We have Stephen Green, who is Jewish. Seymour Hersh, who is Jewish. Andrew and Leslie Coburn, they're not Jewish, but they're respected, quote-unquote, mainstream liberal journalists. They have all documented the fact that John F. Kennedy was involved in a behind-the-scenes war with Israel over Israel's attempt to build a nuclear bomb. Now, everybody knows that John F. Kennedy had his troubles with the CIA over Cuba, and everybody knows that the U.S. got involved in Vietnam after John F. Kennedy's assassination. What people don't know unless they've read these rather esoteric books on U.S. Middle East policy, is that upon John F. Kennedy's assassination, U.S. policy towards Israel did a complete 180-degree turnaround. And as Stephen Green puts it, it essentially made Israel the 51st state. Now, that's all well and good. That's all documented in the book. But just because that happened doesn't mean that there's an Israeli connection to the assassination. I realize that. And my book does not provide any, how should I put this? My book doesn't provide any smoking gun. My book doesn't provide any evidence that could bring an indictment against anybody. But what it does do, it assembles as much evidence, as much detail, as much, probably more so, information about the conspiracy, the depth and breadth of the conspiracy, as any other book on the subject. And that, as I say, is probably its strong point, and that is where the actual Israeli connection comes in the assassination conspiracy. Now, much of my thesis is based around the role of Clay Shaw. Now, if you saw the movie JFK, you know who Clay Shaw was. I'm going to dissect the Clay Shaw connection here because it is important. But I do want to digress for a moment and say this because it's important to emphasize it, that Clay Shaw, if Clay Shaw had never existed, if he had never been alive, my thesis would still stand. But the fact is that Clay Shaw did live. And if you look at the Clay Shaw connection, you do see very clearly the Mossad connection. And I do believe Jim Garrison was right. I do believe that Clay Shaw was connected in some way to the conspiracy. I don't necessarily believe that Clay Shaw knew that John F. Kennedy was going to be assassinated any more than Lee Harvey Oswald did. But I do believe that Clay Shaw was involved in some way with the elements that were involved in the actual mechanics of the conspiracy and the planning of the conspiracy. And then as a consequence of that, that's how Jim Garrison, as District Attorney of New Orleans, came up with his name. And maybe when Clay Shaw said, you know, when he proclaimed his innocence, maybe he truly believed he was innocent. But there were a lot of people who were linked in some way to the JFK assassination who, because they happened to be in a certain place at a certain time, people always say, aha, that's the proof. Now, I mentioned earlier today at a meeting where I spoke that for years I've been reading that the proof that Richard Nixon was involved in the JFK assassination conspiracy, I put the word proof in quotes, was that Nixon was in Dallas the day Kennedy was killed. Well, there were a lot of people in Dallas the day Kennedy was killed. Well, guess who I just found out a few days ago was in Dallas the day Kennedy was killed? Yitzhak Rabin, the future prime minister of Israel. Now, like I say, that's an interesting little detail. It doesn't prove that he was involved in the conspiracy. It doesn't prove that the Israelis were involved in the conspiracy. But it's a detail that nobody knows about. Whereas everybody knows about the Richard Nixon thing. This is the kind of thing, what I constantly tell people is that the basic stories you get about the JFK assassination conspiracy, they give you part of the picture. You don't get the full picture. You know, you're looking, or they tell you to look over here when in fact you should be looking over here. And in the new edition of my book, I put together a couple charts that I think, and I'm going to try to use this blackboard here, and I hope, I don't see, there's an eraser. I'm glad you have it here because I think maybe I can explain my theory best by giving you a few little drawings, and I can draw fairly well, so this might work. I have one theory, which I call the Mossad box theory. See this box, this pretty box right here? That's the Mossad connection to the JFK conspiracy. My box, you can easily fit the CIA did it theory in there. You can put the theory that the mafia did it. You can put the French connection in there. And believe it or not, you can even put the right wingers in there. And I'll explain that in a minute because that's a very interesting story. All of these things taken together can be put together and put in this Mossad box. And they all fit in there very snugly and together, and they don't contradict one another. But the one thing that they all have in common, which ties them together, is the Israeli connection. Now, I know everybody here is worried about the right-wing connection to the Kennedy assassination. You're thinking, I wonder if I know anybody who was involved. Well, now, everybody saw Ed Asner play Guy Bannister. Well, now, every time I read about Guy Bannister being, when these liberals write these books about the JFK assassination, they say, aha, it had to be a right-wing conspiracy because Guy Bannister was involved. And he probably was. Guy Bannister was former FBI. He was mixed up with the CIA. He was mixed up with everybody. He's mixed up with some right-wingers in New Orleans. I hate to mention this name, but you know who two of his good friends were in New Orleans? Husband and wife team. Kent and Phoebe Courtney. I think she's still alive. Well, I'll tell you this much about Kent and Phoebe Courtney. For years, a lot of people on what you might call the hard right, frankly, thought that Kent and Phoebe Courtney were tied up with the Anti-Defamation League. Because I do know this much, that even if they weren't on the payroll of the ADL, for years, they did a lot of things to frustrate the work of people that the ADL didn't like. So if Guy Bannister was a right winger, he was a Kent Courtney, a Kent and Phoebe Courtney kind of right winger. He wasn't our kind of right winger, so to speak. Guy Bannister also had another interesting contact in New Orleans. And this guy was a right winger, very, very anti-communist. And his name was B, that was his nickname, B. Botnick. You know who this right winger was? He headed the ADL office in New Orleans. Now, poor old Steve Frogue was quoted in the Los Angeles Times as saying he thought that the ADL was behind the Kennedy assassination. That isn't what Steve Frogue said. What Steve Frogue, in an interview with the Los Angeles Times, pointed out was that the New Orleans office of the ADL, which was headed by B. Botnick, that was his nickname, had one particular specialty at that time, spying on left-wing civil rights groups. And guess what? That's what Guy Bannister liked to do. And guess what? That's what Kent and Phoebe Courtney, Guy Bannister's good friends, like to do. And guess what? Spying on left-wing groups is what Lee Harvey Oswald was doing when he was running around in New Orleans, setting up his own left-wing group. So, is it a conspiracy theory? It's a theory. This, I admit, is a theory. It's speculation. But I wouldn't be a bit surprised if when poor old Lee Harvey Oswald was running around down in New Orleans prior to the Kennedy assassination, he thought he was spying on left-wing groups for Guy Bannister. And Guy Bannister had a detective agency that did contract work for B. Botnick of the ADL. Now, this is just a theory, mind you. But bottom line of it is, if there were right-wingers like Guy Bannister and Kent and Phoebe Courtney, I don't think they were involved in the conspiracy. I'm not even sure he was involved in the conspiracy either, but they were associated with Oswald. The bottom line of it is, if the right-wing, quote-unquote, was involved in the JFK assassination, the right-wingers who were involved were hooked up to this group right here. So that's just a little detail that I know when it's published in detail in my book, the fourth edition of the book, there's going to be a lot of people who are very upset, and there are going to be these left-wingers who have been promoting this theory for the right wing, that the right wing was behind it, because the right-wingers are all connected. With Israel, and that's very simple. That's kind of scary. That's one little model of this.
You're listening to researcher and author Michael Collins Piper. Today's show, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, let's get down to the real model, which really ties it all together, and it shows you how very simple my book is. A lot of people paint these conspiracies about the JFK assassination that are remarkably complex. And it's like you have all sorts of people tripping over one another plotting to kill JFK. I don't think that was a big conspiracy at all. I keep saying this because I really think it's very simple and yet very profound. The people who were involved in the conspiracy, they weren't one big happy family. They were one small happy family. And as I document in the book, it really took only a handful of people to set the conspiracy in motion. Now, let me show you this Clay-Shaw connection. I've kind of been going around it because those of you who are familiar with JFK know the basic theory about that Jim Garrison presented. Clay-Shaw was a businessman. Let me refer to my notes here because I have a chart. This chart took me literally years to make because I worked. Just because, it finally came to me one afternoon, and I'm glad it did, because I think it really ties it all together. And it is in the new edition of the book, so you're getting a real good preview here. Here's Clay Shaw, the New Orleans businessman who was indicted by Jim Garrison. Now, Shaw was connected with Guy Bannister, who I mentioned earlier, who in turn, of course, is connected with the ADL. There's also a gentleman named David Ferry. He was played by Joe Pesci in the movie. And, of course, you get down here to the lower-level people. This chart, I'm not going to give you the whole thing because I don't want everybody to be confused. This is Lee Harvey Oswald. Here's those Cuban exiles we keep hearing about. Okay. Then you have the mafia. Everybody hears about the mafia and Carlos Marcello. And then you have the CIA. And, of course, the CIA, they were involved, too, just as, of course, you can connect. Is anybody getting confused by this so far? Are you all able to follow along? I'll pass this chart out so you can see it in detail, but I want to explain it up here first. Here's the CIA. This is what this picture right here, I would call this the New Orleans Nexus. This is the standard basic conspiracy theory on a JFK assassination. Well, you had some mafia elements. You had some CIA elements. They were connected. They were all connected to the Cubans, and Oswald was connected. And then there was Clay Shaw, who was connected to the CIA, and Bannister and Ferry and the mafia. This is the part that they leave out. It's very simple, but this is why they have to leave it out. Clay Shaw, Guy Bannister, and David Ferry were all jointly connected in their own fashion, but working together with a company based in Europe. I love this name. It's a great name. I wish I had thought of it myself. Called Permandex. Now, this company existed. This isn't a mythical company. Now, in the movie JFK, you see the character playing Jim Garrison confront Clay Shaw and say, well, you served in the board of a CIA front company called Permandex, and Clay Shaw says, I'm going to sue. That's not true. Well, here's what Oliver Stone doesn't tell you about Permandex. The primary force behind Permandex was a guy named Tiber Rosenthal. He headed the International Credit Bank of Geneva, Switzerland. The International Credit Bank of Geneva, Switzerland was the chief European money laundering operation for Meyer Lansky, which, of course, he was the real boss of the mob. We call it the mafia because that's a good way to frame it on the Italian-Americans. But Meyer Lansky ran organized crime. Meyer Lansky's buddy was Tiber Meyer Lansky. Louis Bloomfield was also a prime mover behind the Israeli lobby in Canada. So now here's the kicker for all this. When some of these quote-unquote liberal JFK assassination researchers go so far as to even mention Permandex, and maybe they'll mention Meyer Lansky, and maybe even mention Louis Bloomfield, the one thing they forget to mention is the Israeli connection. Now, if you can believe this, there's even one guy who gets into Permandex, and he says Permandex was a Nazi front. Now, if Permandex, okay, now, if let's just say he's right. Now, I can't say he's right. If Permandex is a Nazi front, then what's Tiber Rosenbaum and Louis Bloomfield and the Bronfman family, who are very anti-Nazi from what I've heard lately, why are they associated with Permandex? Now, I still haven't really mentioned Israel, because here's the icing on the cake. This guy, Tiber Rosenbaum, and this is all documented in the book. It's taken from mainstream sources. Tiber Rosenbaum was one of the highest-ranking, long-standing money launderers and arms procurement officers for, guess what, the Mossad. He is the Mossad. In fact, I don't even need to add another box there. I could add another box there. But one of Israel's newspapers, when Tiber Rosenbaum got in trouble a few years ago, they said Tiber Rosenbaum is Israel. So without getting into the name, we'll just say, here's a Mossad right here. And Permandex is a Mossad money laundering operation. And Clay Shaw is connected to it, and Guy Bannister is connected to it, and David Ferry is connected to it. And guess who's connected with them? So I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald was involved in the... I don't think he shot John F. Kennedy. But if he did shoot John F. Kennedy, a real detective would say, well, let's see, he's mixed up with Clay Shaw. Well, then, and he was working for Clay Shaw. So, well, who's Clay Shaw mixed up with? Well, this is the thing. You're not allowed to mention any of this. My book mentions all that. And I'm sorry if that upsets people. But if they did it, they did it. And if I'm wrong, all I ask is that somebody come and prove me wrong. One way to prove me wrong is for to have let me speak. And let me pass this out. You can take a look at it close up. Please pass it around. Let's start over here. That's a chart that I've been showing up here. Give you a better idea. If someone wants to prove me wrong, they should have let me come down there to that forum at Saddleback College and let me speak, because there was a guy there who claims that the Nazis did it. Well, I would think that the ADL would want to prove the Nazis did it. So they should have let me talk and just, you know, show me where I'm wrong. That's all I've been asking. You know, if I'm wrong, I want to know where I'm wrong. I've had a couple errors that I found in the book myself. One other error was brought to me, and one of the errors was I said that somebody was held in a prison in Morocco when it was really in Algeria, or vice versa. Well, I corrected that. I said that somebody who knew Lee Oswald, it turned out he didn't know Lee Oswald. I said that one guy had been shot dead when, in fact, he died in his bed. And I, something else. So that's the gist of what the errors have been in my book. There, as I say, I found most of them myself. And the one error that I did find was based on a book written by a former FBI agent. So it was his error, not mine. So the thing is, no one has been able to come forth and show precisely where I'm wrong. I mean, that's all I asked for. I mean, you know, I thought that I was going to write this book. I'd get a certain amount of publicity in the spotlight. Then I get this invitation to come and speak down in Orange County. Little did I know that I didn't create that problem for Orange County. I wasn't the one who called up the press. I wasn't the one who was able to generate press reports all over the country. It was the ADL. You know, and I do actually have them to thank for that, because I have my own little way of thanking the ADL for that. I hope there's somebody from the ADL here, because I want them to see that in a new edition of the book, put a lot of good pictures in, some very interesting pictures. And one of those is, for some reason I don't have it, is a picture of Marcia Milchiker. She's the member of the Board of Advisors, the Board of Trustees down there, who's played a major part in this. She is also on the local board of the Anti-Defamation League. For some reason, I don't have that page out. I must have handed it out to gloat on it. I do see Oliver Stone's picture here.
You're listening to researcher and author Michael Collins Piper. Today's show, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, I got to mention Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone went and made a very good movie. I thought that, you know, great movie. I'm going to trip here in a moment. Made a great movie. He told a lot of things about the JFK conspiracy. There's one thing you got to keep in mind, though, about Oliver Stone. To get that movie made, he had to have some money. Now, when you're going to make them, that's why you have things that are called producers. Now, everybody thinks that Oliver Stone was the producer of the film JFK. Actually, he was, I don't even know what he did. I think he wrote the script. He may have directed it. I'm not even sure he was even the director. Anyway, you're all Hollywood and California people out here, so you guys know what producers are. Here's the name of the man who put up the money for Oliver Stone's film. And he puts up the money for a lot of good movies. I just saw a couple of his movies the other day on video. Now, that's not Michael Milken. That's Arnon Milken. Now, has anyone ever here, unless you, other than those who've read the book, has anyone here know who Arnon Milken is? I heard somebody say he was a Jew. Yeah, I believe he is. And the reason why I believe he probably is because according to Alexander Coburn, writing in The Nation magazine, and as you know, The Nation is not a right-wing extremist publication, Arnon Milken, the man who financed JFK, is, quote, unquote, I love writing this stuff down, Israel's biggest arms dealer. That's a fact, my friends. This is the man who financed the final judgment, so to speak, by the major media on the JFK assassination. Israel's biggest arms dealer. And get a load of this. Guess what one of Arnon Milken's side dabblings is? Oh, of course, he's a movie producer and Israel's biggest arms dealer. And he was also intimately involved in Israel's nuclear arms development. And as I think I mentioned to you earlier, it was Israel's nuclear arms development that was kind of the sticking point between John F. Kennedy and Israel. So I think you understand why Oliver Stone, with Arnon Milken's money coming from Israel's arms dealing and also connected to Israel's nuclear development, would probably not want to get in to the Israeli connection. I think. I mean, maybe I am a conspiracy theorist. I don't know. But like I say, these are just little facts. These are little facts, and I want people to look at them. I want people to see a pattern. It seems like everywhere I turned around when I was researching the Kennedy assassination, I kept finding these Israeli connections. I'll tell you the one that really entertains me, because it's the one that I found literally the day before the book was supposed to go to print. Now, I would not put the burden of writing a book and seeing it through to publication upon any nice person, because it's a lot of work. And when you, Russ knows, I know that. When you have a manuscript in your hands, you know, and you've got it all typeset and everything, you know, you're ready to roll with it, you know, you want it to be done. Well, the day before final judgment was to go to press, I saw something and I said, oh my God, I got to put this in the book. I have to put it in the book. Maybe you won't find this as significant as I do, but that, to me at the time, it was very significant, and it still is. When Jim Garrison, and I found this detail right before the book was supposed to go to press. There's one thing, bear with me. When Jim Garrison started investigating the JFK assassination, he knew nothing about Clay Shaw. He saw that, if those of you who saw the movie know that it was a long process for him before Clay Shaw's name or figured out who Clay Shaw was. Well, before he'd gotten to Clay Shaw, before he had any inkling of who Clay Shaw was, he got a visit from a wealthy businessman named John King. Now, John King has been written about, and this has been written about in books about Garrison by liberals who like what Garrison did. And they say, oh, John King, who was connected to Richard Nixon and connected to the Republican Party, came to visit Jim Garrison and tried to frustrate his investigation. That's a fact. King came down there and said, Mr. Garrison, you're very close. There's a lot of people who would prefer that you would stop this investigation. We would appreciate it if you would. Please, Mr. Garrison. He offered him a judgeship. Jim Garrison said, see the door. Now, like I say, all our liberal friends who are so determined to find out who killed John F. Kennedy, so determined that they don't want to look at anything I have to say, they keep saying John King was this Republican conservative. He probably was. Maybe he was a Republican. Maybe he did know Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon knew a lot of people. But you know what's even more significant? Here's John King. He's American. You know who John King's business partner was? I hate to tell you this. I really hate to tell you this. Bernie Kornfeld of iOS. I hear a lot of laughing. They know who Bernie, a lot of people know who Bernie Kornfeld is. But see, here's the thing about Bernie Kornfeld. Oh, yes, he's Jewish. Yeah, he's Jewish. But Bernie Kornfeld, I'm sorry, what? Well, you're getting closer. Bernie Kornfeld. Yeah, they got him for stock fraud. Bernie Kornfeld, at the same time, was Tibor Rosenbaum's front man. Kornfeld's operation, iOS, was basically a subsidiary of, guess what? Permandex. And this is before Clay Shaw's name had ever been brought up. So Tibor Rosenbaum's man, Bernie Kornfeld, sent his business partner, John King, to see Jim Garrison. Well, the thing is, I'd heard about John King for years, but the day before the book was supposed to go to press, I just happened to be looking through an old newsletter, actually published by Willis Cardo, my boss, published back in the early 1970s. And he just happened to, he didn't write it himself, but one of his reporters happened to mention the connection between John King and Bernie Kornfeld and Tibor Rosenbaum. So my point of telling you that story is that I only discovered that the day before the book went to press. So I had to change a page in the book and put it in there. But it's little details like that, that in seemingly the most insignificant places, keep pointing to an Israeli connection, or maybe I should say the Israeli connection. I've talked for quite a while here, and I could go on and on. I think probably if none of you ever read my book, I think I probably laid a few things out here that will make you think, that give you a new perspective on the whole thing. I'll be looking forward to any questions you might have. I will close with something which is totally unrelated, but I took some pictures here in Washington the other day of something that I guess it is related. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to get this picture at large because I knew I was coming here to Joe's meeting. And I thought, this is just, it looks like a placemat because I had it laminated. But this really says a lot about where the power and the influence is in Washington, D.C. It's Union Station. It's our beautiful train station in Washington. For the last week, they had a 50th anniversary celebration of the State of Israel. That's in Union Station of Washington, not Union Station in Tel Aviv. And you'll see here this picture of the facade of Union Station. You see the American flag hanging here, and you see the Israeli flag hanging here. Note they're both hung at the same level and both the same size. And it's really hard to tell whether you're in Washington or Tel Aviv. But I want you to all look at that picture very, very carefully because, as I say, pass it around if you would. It really says a lot about where the power is in this country today. That's what I'm up against. And that's why my book is so dangerous. Even if I'm wrong, and I don't think that I am, even if I'm wrong, they're afraid that a lot of people are going to believe that I'm right. And they also know that I'm not going to back down. They also know that they can't shut me up. There's only several ways they can shut me up, and it would all involve violence. I don't think that that's going to happen because, unfortunately, they don't always act as we expect them to. But nonetheless, that's why I came out here, because I'm going down there to that Board of Trustees meeting. And I am going to say a few words if I have 3 minutes to speak or if I have 30 minutes to speak. And they're already aware of the fact that there's a lot of people who do support me, or at least who believe that there is such a thing as freedom of speech in this country, who are going to be there, who've been notified. I told this reporter for the Los Angeles Times that I had mailed invitations to 5,000 people. And I want to tell you something. That's probably the first time I ever heard a reporter gulp through the phone. Because he thought I was just planning to come out there, you know, and waltz in and say, "Hi, I'm Mike Piper." For some reason, the Los Angeles Times had not yet found out that I had sent this mailing out. So all of a sudden they realized that there are voters, people who vote in Orange County. I don't know if votes really count anymore, but, you know, a lot of people have that perception that they do. All of a sudden they realize that there are voters from Orange County who have families and family members who vote, who are going to be there seeing what they do. Now, they've known before, Joe and some of the other guys are down there, but hearing that figure, 5,000, they don't think 5,000 people are going to show up. But, you know, politicians do kind of tread lightly when the voters speak. Sometimes it doesn't always seem that way. But all they've been hearing is from the ADL. Now they get to hear personally from me and hopefully from you and hopefully from all of us together. So if you can make it down there, I hope you will be down there. And it's not for me. It's not for my book. It is for the First Amendment. It is for freedom of speech. And it is for America. And that's what they really don't like. So thank you for coming here tonight. Thanks to Joe and Dee. Thank you for your patience. I hope my charts didn't confuse you. I hope they enlightened you. And I'll be glad to answer any questions during our question and answer session.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You've been listening to the late Michael Collins Piper. Today's show has been The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination. Michael Collins Piper was a prolific author, researcher, and journalist. He wrote articles for the American Free Press since its inception in 2001. Prior to that, he wrote for The Spotlight for over 20 years. He is the author of many books, including his most famous, Final Judgment, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination Conspiracy, The Judas Goats, The Enemy Within, The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, The Golem, A World Held Hostage, The High Priests of War, Target Trafficant, The Untold Story, Dirty Secrets, Crime, Conspiracy, and Cover-Up During the 20th Century, among many others. Michael Collins Piper died in May 2015 from heart problems after his house burned down. Visit MikePiperReport.com. That's Mike, P-I-P-E-R, report.com, and AmericanFreePress.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit snipers trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace. Release. You dig me? You got me?
Everybody knows, moving now. Time to look, what's that sound? Everybody knows. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can find us on Facebook / The Taylor Report, and we are on SoundCloud, Taylor-Report.
And can we remind our listeners that you can still donate and be entered in the draw for the trip to Iceland? We've had a very successful donation drive at CIUT. Our goal was $60,000. We've met it. But if you didn't get a chance to participate, you still can go to the website, ciut.fm, make a contribution, and your name is entered into the draw.
Yep. There's a number of things we could talk about here in the remaining time. I don't know if readers have, or listeners have noticed that the Globe and Mail, who last week wrote an article about global research, and I've analyzed them and figured out what it is that the Globe and Mail doesn't like about this independent website, which is full of what I would call educated opinion, not all right, not all wrong. It's like the Taylor Report. But at any rate, it's a website run by retired professor Mr. Jasadowski. And they said that NATO has targeted Mr. Jasadowski, and therefore the Globe thought they'd better do their part, I guess, and help out. And I discovered that they have – I'll ask you, Phil, to read the name of the organization. It's about you can find it about the second paragraph down. NATO has something called the Committee of Excellence. And
NATO's Strategic Communications Center of Excellence is monitoring a website for pro-Russian propaganda and disinformation.
Now, see, this is what I want to share with you, Phil. I did not realize that NATO had
Communications Center for Excellence.
Communications Center for Excellence. Yes. Who knew? I mean, are we part of this? And then the Globe writer who says that Steed says she was in touch with Jasadowski, and she said that she explained to him about about journalism, but he wasn't convinced. I read the Globe, so let me join Professor Jasadowski. I'm not convinced either. The Globe says that they are the first of the big journals to join this new thing that it is going to protect the truth or establish facts. I just assume they didn't do that. And when she writes saying that most of you know how to read articles and understand and separate truth from blah, blah. But I don't know whether I got a passing grade or didn't get, but she says most of you. And so I'm supposed to call her up and say, is there a test I can take to make sure, to determine whether or not I need to be protected by the Globe and Mail to tell me not to listen or read anything on the Jasadowski site? And it's a very the first article was offensive, in my opinion, because we really don't need somebody from the Excellence and Communication Department of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I don't know if she knows this. It's actually a military group, you know. So these are what we call apparatchiks. Nobody voted any of them into office, none of them. We have no means of reviewing. I don't even know if the apparatchik who gave an exclusive interview to the Globe, whether those apparatchiks were in touch with, say, a Canadian NATO member. You would think maybe they would out of simple respect. So, you know, how about we ask the Canadian in NATO? NATO is a large, shiny place in Brussels. I was once crossing the street in Belgium, in Brussels, and a friend of mine grabbed my sleeve and pulled me back, and I was nearly run over by a bus. And I'll never forget, it said NATO on the front of the bus because it was going to the NATO headquarters. So I nearly got run over by NATO. So maybe I'm just sensitive. But this business, in the middle of the article, I want to go back to something that I noticed and I hadn't called. Last week we discussed this. In the middle of the article, the two authors say, there's been this growing concern about Russia. Well, maybe on their part, not mine. I mean, this is a political world. I get to decide whether I'm concerned or not. But anyway, they're very concerned. And they said, readers will remember that in May, Foreign Minister Freeland warned us about disinformation and distortion news, this sort of thing. Well, actually, I remember May, and I remember what happened because a reporter, it might have been a Globe reporter, asked her, there is a story that your grandfather, who you always speak of lovingly and respectfully, was actually, in fact, a Nazi collaborator. And by the way, that was not a Russian story. That came from Western Canada, from a young Ukrainian. We interviewed him on this show. If the Globe wants to look it up, just call me. I'll help you out. But it was a Canadian, not a Russian. And what in the archives in Alberta is a lot of boxes left by Chrystia Freeland's grandfather, indicating he was indeed a well-paid, long-time collaborator with Nazis. Now, the reporters in the Globe say she reminded us that the Russians are trying to smear us, you know. But that wasn't a smear. I wonder if the Globe would help me out on this, and they could come join me any day of the week. We'll make time for them. Why haven't they acknowledged that that was a fact? And why hasn't Chrystia Freeland acknowledged it's a fact? Our foreign minister, to this day, has never addressed the matter of her grandfather. I'm not saying that she agrees with her grandfather. I'm saying she doesn't disagree with him. She has never said a word. And she wants us to regard it as a smear. So here's my question for the Globe. If it is a fact, how is that a smear? How is that a distortion? You have some serious homework to do. Don't call NATO, by the way. That would not be your best, you know, if you want to learn how to do this. Try to get at the facts. And a lot of us want to know why Chrystia Freeland to this day doesn't feel even no moral compunction to tell us about Grandpa. And again, I'm not condemning her. I'm only saying, how come you don't just put it clear the air? Was he a collaborator or not? And you can say what you think. Maybe you liked that. Maybe you didn't like it. But to say the Russians are smearing me when in fact they're just telling you something, your fellow Canadians. I can cite five or six really highly respected Canadian columnists who have put that same question. Would she please clear the air? No, she will not, so far. But that was in the middle of the Globe article. She warned us. Yeah, she's exhibit A of a problem we have. Can we discuss these things or not? Are we all going to get smeared as pro-Russia if we ask her, is it true that your grandfather was a Nazi collaborator? Is that the truth? So that's the name of that song, as they say. This has been the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And Francois, thank you very much.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Newts, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Lance DeHaven Smith speaks with wit and wisdom on conspiracy theories, State Crimes Against Democracy, and the get-out-of-jail-free card that every administration official seems to have in his wallet. I hope you'll stay tuned. Probably all of us have some unusual quirk. A quirk that makes you different from the majority of people. To others, if they even know you have it, your quirk may seem like a harmless eccentricity, easily forgiven or overlooked. To you, though, it's not just a preference, it's part of who you are. You feel comfortable when you're among others who share your quirk, and you feel a little edgy when you're surrounded by normal people. Do you know what I mean? I myself have a handful of quirks like this. One of them is, I guess, I'm an intellectual and a scholar at heart. Might as well come out of the closet and acknowledge it. Can't do anything about it. Might as well just accept it. One habit of mind of the scholar and intellectual is judiciousness. I admire that trait a lot. Judiciousness means being very sure that your conclusions are based on reliable evidence, and enough of it. Judiciousness also means getting very clear in your own mind about what you know for certain, and what you conclude is probably true, but you don't know for certain, and what is hypothesis or speculation. These are important distinctions. The propagandists who shape public opinion don't want you to think judiciously. They want you to believe what they tell you and then act accordingly without further thought. That's why America needs scholars and intellectuals. So I was excited to discover a new voice, a scholar I had never heard of, and an interesting one. He is Lance DeHaven Smith. That's hyphenated, DeHaven Smith. He's professor of public administration and policy at Florida State University, and he is the author of the scholarly book Conspiracy Theory in America, published in 2013. DeHaven Smith says it is he who invented the term SCADS, which stands for State Crimes Against Democracy. SCADS. He argues that a SCAD is a more useful concept than the pejorative term conspiracy theory. In fact, the term conspiracy theory was introduced into mainstream usage by the CIA itself. This was a smear designed to discredit citizens who were looking closely into the JFK assassination. This week and next, we'll hear DeHaven Smith talk about the concept of SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. And he'll discuss some actual proven SCADs, such as candidate Richard Nixon's treasonous subversion of the Paris peace talks in 1968, and the Watergate affair, also the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And here the speaker again is being judicious. He'll talk about events that look like they were probably SCADs, but we don't yet have enough evidence to be certain. These include the JFK assassination and at least some of the events of 9/11/2001. Speaking in Denver in September 2013, speaking of SCADs and conspiracy theories, here is Lance DeHaven Smith.
I thought there would be investigations after the 2000 election and that the crimes that were committed would be prosecuted or at least made known. And what happened instead was people were told, just move on, get over it. You know, there was an investigation, but it was set up so that it said the inquiry was about the technology and it wasn't about the partisanship in the election administration. Have you seen this movie, Recount? It goes over, well, they're actual crimes that are displayed in the movie, but you don't know they're crimes unless you know the law. On the morning after the election, after Election Day, the general counsel, the lawyer in Governor Jeb Bush's office, called the five largest law firms in Florida and told them that the governor didn't want them working for Al Gore. And they didn't work for him. He had to hire an attorney from out of state. They got boys. This is reported in the movie. It's just kind of a matter-of-fact thing. But the reality was that that was a felony. That was use of public office for coercion. They were threatening these law firms with loss of business if they took on Gore's case. Well, there were many crimes like that committed during the 2000 election, and nothing was done. And even the movie recount, you know, it shows James Baker. He comes across as this real tough guy who's, you know, really competent. And Warren Christopher, the leader of the Democratic of Gore's campaign, comes across as this wimp who gets, you know, pushed around by Baker. The reality was Warren Christopher was following the law. He was doing what the law said. He wanted to do the right thing, and Baker was abusing the law. So it was very frustrating seeing this, and I wrote a book about the 2000 election and specified the crimes that were committed. It was published by the University Press of Florida, an academic book. Got relatively little attention, but it laid the facts were there. But when I saw that nothing was going to happen about it, I started studying this topic, and I came up with this term, state crimes against democracy. I have a definition for it: concerted actions or inactions by government insiders intended to manipulate democratic processes and undermine popular sovereignty. It's a terribly turgid definition. The way I developed it was I did a list of what these suspicious events are. There's some that we know, there's no dispute about the Watergate break-in, the crimes of Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, the outing of Valerie Plame, the lying us into war in Iraq. This is all documented. So we know that there are these high crimes to subvert democratic processes. But I did a list that included others that we suspect that. The Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, George Wallace, the attempt on his life, the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life, the 1968 October surprise. I'll tell you about what these are. But anyway, it was a long list. It was like 20-something events, about a third of which were well-confirmed and others we were suspicious about. And I extrapolated from that list to come up with this definition. The basic idea was to have a name for the type of crime that the term conspiracy theory discourages us from speaking about. If we can't name the crime, it's very hard to discuss it. I say actions or inactions. When there's a stand down like there was on 9/11 appears to be, where people don't defend the country, that's a SCAD. That's a crime in itself. It's a treason, a form of treason. The Vietnam War was started on a false pretense. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed. We had our gunships off the islands of North Vietnam, and we were firing on these islands, large cannon fire. And then when the North Vietnamese would come out, we would race back to international waters. Our ships reported they were attacked in the summer of 1964, and they said that they were doing nothing. They were in international waters, minding their own business. And so the administration lied to Congress and got that war started when it was really a provocation or a kind of an inaction. I use government insiders because it isn't always the case that it's somebody in government. It can be a political insider. I'm thinking about Nixon. Nixon in 1968 was running for president. And there were peace talks going on between North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the United States. And Nixon thought if they made peace, that he would not win the election, that Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic candidate, would win the election. And so he sent word to North Vietnam, to their president, saying, withdraw from the peace talks, and I'll get you a better deal. That's a treason. I mean, what the man did was treason. The reason we know about this is because Lyndon Johnson, we have a taped telephone call between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen, a U.S. Senator, Republican leader, at the time. And Lyndon Johnson knew that Nixon had done this because he had wiretapped Nixon's plane, his campaign plane. Yeah, I mean, these guys, I mean, they do all this stuff. I mean, Mission Impossible, you know. I mean, this is what these people do. This came out in 1997, and Johnson is talking to Dirks, and he says, I can't believe he's done this. He sabotaged the peace talks. This is treason, but I'm not going to tell the American people because it would destroy their faith in their leaders and their country. So we learn about this in 1997. It's in the news one day. You know, and this is these events, they eventually, many of them, they eventually become known, and we understand the dynamics of them and who was involved. But it's often long after the event. It receives very little attention, and there's no effort to go back and rewrite history with the awareness of this. But anyway, the point was Nixon was not in office, but he was a political insider, and he was doing this as an anti-democratic high crime. I've written a number of articles about this. I won't belabor this much, but I wanted you to know I first wrote about it and defined the state crimes against democracy concept or construct in 2006. And I started working with this guy, Matthew Witt. Matthew T. Witt is a professor at Laverne University in California. And I have to tell you, when you accept that John Kennedy was assassinated by the government, and the evidence is very strong for that, at the very least, the government covered up that it was a conspiracy. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And once you come to understand that, you should rethink how you think about American government. From then on, you should say, well, you know, these guys are capable of some pretty outlandish things. But my tendency was I would admit this about Kennedy. I would admit Watergate. Everybody knows Watergate. I think we tend to minimize it. Watergate is called the Watergate burglary. It was actually a wiretapping. And the people who were arrested were going back in to the National Democratic Party headquarters. They had wiretapped it 3 weeks prior. And they were they had transcripts and they were reading them. But one of the wiretaps went out. So they were going back into the National Democratic Party headquarters to replace that wiretap, and they got arrested. The two principals, Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, worked for the White House and were consultants for the Committee to Reelect the President. They had planned to kill Jack Anderson, an investigative reporter, and Teddy Kennedy, and they had monitored Teddy Kennedy's activities, but the plan was called off. There are many other things. I mean, when the guys were arrested, Howard Hunt sent his wife, Dorothy Hunt, to the White House to tell the White House, look, all of these people that have been arrested in Watergate have obligations. We have mortgages to pay. We have kids in college. We expect our expenses to be covered. They said, if you're in the CIA and you're arrested overseas, they take care of your family. And they felt like they were working for the president. They thought it was a legitimate operation, and they should be covered. Nixon referred to it as hush money. He understood it was blackmail. And John Dean speaks about Dorothy Hunt and says that she was just a completely savvy person, that she was, you know, wife of a CIA agent and had gone all over the world, and she had been a CIA agent in France before she married Howard Hunt. Well, Dorothy gets several hundred thousand dollars for the Watergate burglars, as they call it. They call the Watergate burglars because the day after it happened, the press secretary of President Nixon said, this is a third-rate burglary attempt. We had nothing to do with it. It's just a screw-up by these overzealous campaigners. And we call it a burglary to this day when it was espionage at the highest level, you know, attacking the opposition Democratic Party during a presidential election. What I wanted to tell you about Dorothy Hunt, though, was she was on a plane flight to Chicago with $10,000 in cash to disperse, and her plane crashed, and she was killed. There was a grand jury impaneled in Chicago, and they brought Robert Haldeman in to testify, because they thought it had been that he had killed her, that the Nixon people had killed her. There was no evidence, and all they did was make him testify, and then they let him go. We know this in part because Haldeman tells this to Nixon in the White House, and we have it on the White House tapes. But the point is, Watergate was more than a burglary. I mean, we're talking about a crime spree of fairly wide proportions. The break-in to Howard Hunt's psychiatrist office, Ellsberg's psychiatrist office, there were 100 break-ins like that around Washington at that time, where the people's psychiatrists had their files rifled when they were providing service, psychoanalytic services to very important people's wives or husbands. So Watergate was, you know, this massive crime spree. Witt got me thinking about it in those terms. You know, he would say, I would say, well, you know, Nixon was crazy. I thought of Nixon as a, I mean, I think most of us do think about him as, you know, he was paranoid and nuts and a gangster. It took me a while to get used to the idea that a lot of them are like that. It's not just him, you know? So he helped me with that. We wrote an article in 2010 that was published in the American Behavioral Scientist, which is a fairly widely read journal. And there was an op-ed that was written by Mickey Huff, some guys at Project Censored. They said that they wrote about this study, and they submitted it to an online website that they had published other things in, and they were told they would not publish this because it was on conspiracy theory. And they were stunned. I mean, they said, this is what we do. We publicize things that are being stifled, and we had this outlet, and they told us that we couldn't publish on that. But I don't think many people would have read it if these guys hadn't publicized it. I wrote an article on the Nuremberg War Crimes trials, and this was kind of shocking to me to go back and read about this. I was teaching a class on international conflict and international law. So I read the Constitution, I read the UN Charter, and I read the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and the 2001 authorization to use military force against the people who planned 9/11 and the 2002. And what I found was we break the law all the time. Okay? I mean, when we threaten Syria, that's a violation of the UN Charter. We are signatories to the UN Charter. Our Constitution says our treaties are the highest law of the land. They're higher than the law. They're higher than the Constitution. And that treaty says we're not going to invade people unless we're being attacked. And we have to get a resolution from the United Nations to continue, even if we're attacked. We have to get their support to continue it. But we violate it all the time. Well, I went back. I said, you know, let's look at the Nuremberg War Crimes trials. And to my surprise, what I found was that the first charge in the indictment of the Nazi war criminals was a conspiracy charge. They had conspired to overthrow the parliamentary government in Germany and then warmonger and strike fear into people's hearts and then start an aggressive war against other countries. Do you know what we did to these people? We hung them. They included not only politicians, they included diplomats who were fronting for the Nazi war of aggression. They included journalists who were warmongers and anti-Semites. They included lawyers. We prosecuted these criminal cases because after the war, Stalin said, let's kill all the officers in the Nazi army. And Churchill said, no, we can't do that. Let's kill 20,000 of them. And it was kind of glib, but that's really what they said. And the Americans said, no, we have to teach a lesson to the German people. We have to show them what their leaders did, and we have to show them that they have a responsibility as citizens in an elected representative democracy to not let power be consolidated and to never let this happen again. The Germans have learned that lesson pretty well. I mean, they're very cautious about what they do in foreign policy. So what I did in this article was simply compare what the Bush-Cheney administration did in terms of twisting the intelligence and telling people that we were going to be potentially that this country was trying to build nuclear bombs and had weapons of mass destruction and they could give them to terrorists and we were in peril, when they knew otherwise. They knew otherwise. They, you know, the torture that we talk about? The torture occurred in August of 2002 at Guantanamo Bay. There were two people tortured, and they were waterboarded like 186 times. I mean, it was a horrendous thing. But what they were doing was trying to get confessions linking 9/11 to the country of Iraq. And once they couldn't get that, they stopped it. There was Abu Ghraib and all that. That was different. This was torture that came right out of the White House. So anyway, I did this article and said, if you look at what the Bush-Cheney administration did and you compare it to our charges against the Nazis at Nuremberg, you'll find they're parallel, almost exactly, bang, bang, bang. I could not get that published in the United States. I had it reviewed at one journal three times, and the reviewers kept saying, this is a great article. This is an important article. We cannot publish it. Literally, I'd never seen anything like this. I submitted it to Contemporary Politics, was the name of the journal, and they published it right away. It's published in London. It's a British journal. It taught me a lesson about what we're up against. Science is supposed to be a search for the truth. It's not an organ of legitimation for the power structure in America, but that's pretty much what it appears to be because it was too controversial. But the reason I tell you about it is you're probably not aware of the academic background on it. And there's a pretty good body of research now that establishes that there are these kinds of crimes. They need to be looked at comparatively and collectively together so you see patterns in them. And that you can't depend on the government to... There are a number of reasons I'll go over why we can't depend on the government to give us the truth. There's a book from Paul Gray Macmillan on state crimes against democracy. That's the title of the book. So the term's getting out. That just came out about 3 months ago. I won't belabor this, but I just want to point out that SCAD is not a conspiracy theory. It's not a term for that. It's a term for the crime. We wouldn't say white-collar conspiracy, you know, or white-collar theory. We would say white-collar crime. And it's the same way with state crimes. You have to think in terms of crimes, not theories of crimes. I think y'all know that it's a pejorative term. The problems with the term conspiracy theory, it's a totally nonsensical term. The way it's used is anything that is suspicious of government insiders conspiring to subvert democratic processes is considered ludicrous, paranoid. Well, it's nonsensical because we know conspiracies happen. We had Watergate. We had Iran-Contra. We had Plangate. We know conspiracies happen. So it's crazy to say any suspicion of conspiracy has got to be ludicrous. It's quite the opposite. You should be carefully discerning what are reasonable suspicions and what are not. The conspiracy theory label lumps everything together, from aliens taking over the planet to who assassinated Kennedy. And you lump them all together and then take the most ludicrous example and equate all other suspicions with that. That's not reasonable. That's unreasonable. Conspiracy theory label is un-American. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory. I urge you to read it. The first part of the Declaration is about inalienable rights, but then it goes on to list a set of crimes that King George committed or was suspected of committing that were intended together to deprive the colonists of their rights as British citizens. And they said they suspected that King was trying to gain tyranny over them and that gave them the right. Not any of the crimes individually, but what they suspected about his motives. So people who say conspiracy theory is ludicrous forget that America was founded on a conspiracy theory. When people use the term conspiracy theory, what they're forcing on you, in addition to shutting you up and saying that you're crazy, what they're suggesting is that the official account of these events is solid, strong evidence, and what you've got is speculation and, you know, at the very least, dubious. But in reality, if you look at the official accounts of things like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, basically they are coincidence theories. They're troubling patterns that on their face look suspicious, and they're dismissed as coincidences. When you talk about 9/11 to somebody, or the anthrax letter attacks, or the Kennedy assassination, they will tell you that the American government would not commit crimes like this. And furthermore, if they did commit them, they're not competent enough to do it. They couldn't pull it off. And furthermore, if they, by some fluke, they did succeed in doing one of these things, they couldn't keep it quiet. Somebody would talk. So there's this assumption that you couldn't do these things. They're just on its face. I have Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, the cover up there. It's a great book. What he reminds us of is that the Manhattan Project, which involved 100,000 people developing the atomic bomb, was kept secret throughout World War II. Totally secret. Truman, when he became president after FDR died, he did not know about the atomic bomb for a week until they told him. It's kept secret through compartmentalization, the need to know. People are working on it, but they don't know what it is. They're doing this part, they're doing that part, building the casing, you know. So it's quite easy for the government to keep secrets. It does an excellent job of it. It's got a very sophisticated technique for doing it. Ellsberg also points out that people who are privy to these secrets think they are really special, think that they really know what's up. So they don't want to tell anybody. What they do is remain silent. He says they listen to people and they think in their minds, if this person knew what I knew, they wouldn't be saying what they're saying. They consider everybody else really just foolish and out of the loop. And the last problem with the conspiracy theory label is that people who use it attack individuals. They attack individuals who say that John Kennedy was killed by more than one shooter, or 9/11 was a controlled demolition of the buildings. They attack individuals, but they never talk about the conspiracy theories of the institutions, of the government itself. The conspiracy theory of Iraq trying to get nuclear weapons. Now, that was a dangerous conspiracy theory. That was a conspiracy theory that cost 100,000 lives and thousands of our soldiers. That was a dangerous conspiracy. Does anybody say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, you shouldn't say that? No, no. So it's really a terrible term.
Lance DeHaven Smith, speaking on what's wrong with the term conspiracy theory and, more importantly, what's wrong with the government itself committing major crimes to further its own ends. That was part one. More of this interesting talk next week. Our thanks to Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests for supplying and editing the original recording. I have edited it some more myself. UnwelcomeGuests.net. That's them. And NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. That's us. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I'm joined in the studio today by local author Patrick Nolan. His latest book is called CIA Rogues and the Killing of the Kennedys, How and Why U.S. Agents Conspired to Assassinate JFK and RFK. And the foreword is written by Dr. Henry Lee. Patrick Nolan is a forensic historian who has dedicated his life to uncovering truths surrounding the JFK, MLK, and RFK assassinations of the 1960s. He's been a journalist, a television news producer, and professor at Hofstra University and St. John's University. He lives with his wife in West Hartford, Connecticut. And he joins me today on the show to discuss his book on the Kennedy assassinations. Patrick Nolan, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Cheryl.
Patrick, you wrote the book CIA Rogues and the Killings of the Kennedys, How and Why U.S. Agents Conspired to Assassinate JFK and RFK, which came out in November of 2015. Could you tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write the book?
Well, I was always concerned since the 60s, very concerned about why these assassinations had taken place and why the official stories, in many ways, didn't add up. I also had a personal connection. I had seen John Kennedy when he was president in 1962, came to Waterbury, gave a speech. Mm-hmm. The whole family went down, and it was a big event. And being Irish Catholic from Waterbury, we were so thrilled to have this person in the White House. And then, of course, when he was assassinated, it was devastating. And I read everything I could on it. And this is back in 63. And so since then, and I've continued to read as much as I can. And I've found that the discrepancies are overwhelming. And then when Bobby was killed when I was in college, and by the way, I had actually met Bobby when he campaigned in Waterbury in 66 in the fall. Mm-hmm. And I was one of those kids that reached up and shook his hand as the car drove by.
Oh, wow. See the
documentary films. And it was great. And we thought he would be the next president. And then when he was cut down in June of 68, we started really thinking, wait a minute, what is happening here? And as it turns out, in my thesis in my book is basically that Bobby wanted to find out also who killed his brother, John. And that was the main reason he ran for president. And then he was hit by the same people. And the evidence all points to that.
And we'll talk about who those people were in a little bit. So you are a forensic historian. Can you just tell people what that means?
People are familiar with forensic scientists and forensic accountants. A forensic historian is someone who studies the past, primarily crimes, and studies the physical evidence to try and find out what really happened, because they know that the past in many ways determines the future. If we better understand the past, we can make the present and the future better. So a forensic historian is one who really wants to know and better understand the past through the study of forensics.
And in terms of JFK, the government, of course, says that it was the lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald. Can you tell us a little bit about why you think it wasn't him?
Well, the evidence shows that he didn't have a motive. In fact, the evidence shows that he wasn't even on the sixth floor at the time of the Texas School Book Depository at the time the assassination took place. Witnesses saw him in the lunchroom just minutes before and a minute after. That is not what an assassin would have done.
Yeah.
So he was sitting there. They saw him. So his whole life, Oswald's life, if you really study it, he was in intelligence himself, military intelligence. Mm-hmm. He went in the service at 17. He spoke fluent Russian. There's only one place you could learn fluent Russian at 17 that I can think of.
And that, where was that?
That is a pretty good school.
The Defense Language Institute?
It's the Defense Language Institute, as we've been able to put the pieces of the puzzle together. The Defense Language Institute trains young soldiers, Marines, Navy men in various languages. We call them target languages. Mm-hmm. And their job is to intercept military communications. Tanks, missile sites, airplanes, ships, any kind of foreign or military communications, translate it. Some of them break codes. So their job is really to work for the National Security Agency. Clearly, Oswald was a Marine working for the National Security Agency, which is connected with the whole spy and intelligence network. He was assigned to a top-secret base in Japan, CIA base at Atsugi, Japan, which is the base where they had the U-2 spy flights flying out of. They were supersonic, high-altitude planes that could photograph a license plate from 90,000 feet.
Wow.
Yeah. But also they could picking up sound. They could pick up any communications going on in Russia.
So here we have this Lee Harvey Oswald being actually an insider in the NSA. And after Kennedy was shot, he says, "I'm a patsy." So he didn't really know he was being set up for this.
Right. He was an unwitting fall guy. He was a patsy. And he said he was. And the evidence shows that the intelligence community at that time did have a program of creating unwitting fall guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was called MKUltra. It started in the 50s. And by the early 60s, they had perfected it. Actually, the goal was to create a Manchurian candidate, someone who could be programmed to go out and kill and not remember. It didn't work 100%. It was unreliable. Mm-hmm. They used too much drugs or hypnotism. The subject would be a vegetable. If they didn't use enough, he would be too unpredictable. Oh. So it didn't work. But then they hit on the idea of having the unwitting fall guy, who was drugged and hypnotized, be the fall guy, but use expert marksmen on the sidelines. And that's what we saw in Dallas, and that's what we saw in the Bobby Kennedy murder in the Ambassador Hotel.
You've talked about Lee Harvey Oswald. Let's talk about Sirhan Sirhan a bit. You're saying he was mind-controlled?
Yes.
Yeah.
The symptoms that we've been able to identify of MKUltra mind control would be sudden change in behavior. And first of all, before that, he was missing for 3 months right before the assassination of Bobby. Where he was those 3 months, no one knows. They just can't determine it, which is very odd.
Yeah, very interesting.
But it would take those 3 months to do hypnoprogramming of someone. But anyway, you come back, you're irritable, depressed, for no reason at all. Mm-hmm. His views had changed on things. He had, besides mood swings, at times he was in a stupor for no reason. Rapid speech. All these symptoms of programming did start to appear. He has no memory of the assassination. He has no memory of writing some notebooks that they used to show premeditation, the courts.
And weren't there some people working to get him out of jail?
He's had various lawyers over the years.
Uh-huh.
Early on, there was a Dr. Edward Simpson who tried to, actually, he wanted to deprogram him. Uh-huh. He wanted to break inside the barrier to bring back the memories that weren't there. And he was told to stop. He was at San Quentin Prison, and he was ordered not to deal with Sirhan anymore, and then he left the job. And since then, I've heard that there has been another group more recently, much more recently, the current attorney, Dr. William Pepper, who has tried to do the same thing and break through and retrieve these lost memories. But clearly he was framed. The gun that he used, there's evidence in the barrel that there were blanks. Witnesses saw two other gunmen firing. The sound recording shows 14 shots. Sirhan's gun was only an 8-shot revolver. Plus, Bobby was hit in the back of the head and in the back. Sirhan was like 3 or 4 feet in front. So nothing matches up.
So where was the mainstream media and all this, the corporate media? I mean, they didn't report any of that, did they?
You know, the whole investigation was controlled by two LAPDs who were also CIA people.
Uh-huh.
They had careers in the CIA in Latin America. Manny Pena and Hank Hernandez, these two men, not coincidentally, I'm sure, ended up running the investigation for LAPD.
Right,
and so they controlled the media.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But now you, as an independent researcher, have come up with solid evidence that contradicts the Warren Commission. Why can't the corporate media be doing that?
Well, there was an Operation Mockingbird during that time, and planned by CIA Director Richard Helms at that time and James Angleton, the head of counterintelligence, to plant CIA people, scores of them, throughout the media. Operation Mockingbird was set up by the CIA to place CIA operatives in the media and to make sure that stories that were coming out did not conflict with the official version on both the John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy assassinations. So there are a number of other reasons that the media doesn't run conspiracy-type stories. In fact, I have 6 quick reasons. Can I give you them?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
They're naive in many ways. If you're under age 54, you weren't born when John Kennedy was killed. You weren't even born yet. People born after 1963, their teachers really taught them the official version, and they had no reason to question it because they didn't hear the alternative points of view. The second reason is many of the media were brainwashed by the CIA, and through that Operation Mockingbird and whatever, people like Bill O'Reilly and a number of writers and journalists, they have been brainwashed. I really believe that. They won't deviate from the official view. Some are twisted, meaning that they feel it's unpatriotic to say that the government would kill its own leaders, mm-hmm. the rogues within the government, and we don't want to appear unpatriotic. Then there are some that are scared to write against the official view because they don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to get fired. Even Ben Bradley, editor of the Washington Post, mm-hmm. said, I didn't write much about it because I didn't think it would help my career, mm-hmm. meaning that he was worried about his reputation. So they're yeah. scared. And then some are ignorant. In other words, they're good writers. They're communications majors. They go into journalism, but they don't know history. And that's a big problem. I think if you have to study history to be a journalist.
Yes, they might study history, but what they're learning might be a false history.
But you might learn some principles that there is such a thing as false history by
right.
studying history. You know, and so they're ignorant. And then there's another group that the journalists, they're apathetic. It's like, who cares? How does that affect us? And they don't realize that the past does affect us because it determines in many ways how we're going to plan the future.
Yeah.
Okay. And then finally, there are the ones that are greedy and they simply know the truth, but they know that they can make more money by printing the official version. So they continue the Warren Commission myths.
And of course, as you mentioned, many of them are CIA.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're still there. It's an important business that they're
yeah.
in. The CIA, how do they operate? They do three things. First, they monitor, mm-hmm. then they infiltrate, then they penetrate. Monitor means they watch groups. They watch Muslim groups. They watch the media. They watch any group that might be an issue. Then they infiltrate. Infiltrate means to become members of that group. They probably members of the 9/11 group.
I've seen that in our local groups.
Right. They're,
yeah.
Sure. They,
yeah.
they're working for the government, CIA, or intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. They're in, say, the 9/11 group, whatever. And they monitor, they infiltrate, mm-hmm. and then they penetrate. Penetrate means that they take over the group. Or they lead a part mm-hmm. of the group, lead them to where they want them to go. And where they want them to go many times is probably to be destroyed, to destroy them.
Yeah, I've actually seen that in our local peace groups.
Oh, yeah. It's real big. It was called Operation Chaos in the 60s.
Yeah.
Tried to destroy the peace groups, the civil
yeah.
rights groups, the black groups.
Yeah, and I think it's very effective. I have
oh,
to
yeah.
say it is. And any kind of activist group, in order to be successful, needs to understand that this is happening and develop some skills to deal with it. And that's hard. So tell us, who did it? You think it's the same people in both situations, JFK, RFK? Who did it?
Well, the people that have the means, the motive, and the opportunity, more than anybody, is this what I call the CIA rogues. And that would be Richard Helms, James Angleton, David Phillips, E. Howard Hunt. Those four key people that were active in the 50s through the 70s. They had help from the mob. They had an alliance with the mob. They were using the mob, Johnny Roselli, to help overthrow or assassinate Fidel Castro in Cuba. They also had help from Santo Trafficante in Miami and, of course, Carlos Mencillo in New Orleans. So that alliance with the mob and their own people, you could see that the fingerprints of intelligence are all over both cases, the case of Oswald and the case of Sirhan Sirhan. And Sirhan Sirhan, there's a military intelligence report that we found after the assassination that was written before the assassination of a background report on Sirhan Sirhan. I wonder, why would the CIA have a background report on CIA before the assassination?
Right.
You know,
yeah,
there's no
makes
reason.
Sense. Yeah.
You know? And then we know about Dr. William Bryan has admitted to friends and colleagues. He was a CIA programmer hypnotist. He was a psychotherapist. But he has told friends that he did program Sirhan Sirhan. So we have that evidence.
Wow.
And then, of course, I just told you about the two CIA people who worked at LAPD who ran the investigation. So there's three links right there. In the Oswald case, he learned Russian through the National Security Agency before, and then it was a fake defection. The fake defection to Russia after he left the Marine Corps was another program set up by James Angleton, whom I just mm-hmm. mentioned, who was head
yeah.
of counterintelligence. One of his main goals was to try and get people into Russia to dig up intelligence, and Oswald was one of those people. He didn't defect. He was a fake defector. We also know that he met with David Phillips, the head of the Western Hemisphere, David Phillips, in 63, September 63. And this was in Dallas, and he was seen by Anthony Vecchiana, who was the head of Alpha 66, trying to overthrow Castro. Why would David Phillips be meeting with Oswald in Dallas 2 months before the assassination?
Mm-hmm.
So there are so many links here where you could see that the rogues within the CIA ran both assassinations. All of Oswald's friends were connected with the CIA. David Ferry in New Orleans, Dennis Offstein in Dallas. even in Russia, his close friend was Dr. Alexei Davison, who was the head of one of the key spy rings of the CIA in Moscow during the early 60s, late 50s. Guy Bannister in New Orleans, George DeMornschel, best friend of Lee Harvey Oswald. Mm-hmm. We know he was CIA.
You know? Didn't he wind up getting killed in the end, too?
Well, in 77, the House Select Committee on Assassinations was calling him to come because they wanted to talk to him. And they went to his house, and he was found dead. They said it was a suicide. His wife said it wasn't a suicide. She wasn't home, but she said he never would have done it. He was killed. He had a bullet hole in his mouth.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned that David Ferry, and I was reading another book about Barry and the boys. David Ferry was very much involved in drug running, and the CIA was involved in that, too. So it all kind of...
Well, he was a pilot, so he played a key role in helping the mob and the CIA fly people and drugs. And he knew Oswald when Oswald was 16. Oswald was in the Civil Air Patrol at 16, and his leader was David Ferry. Then they met up again 7 years later when Oswald was 23 in Dallas.
So it's a small circle there, yeah. You know, tell me, we talked about this DeMornschel dying. There were a lot of people, I understand, that died mysteriously around the Kennedy assassination. Can you tell us more about that?
That's really important, and it's key witnesses during the time of the Warren Commission was studying the case. Mm-hmm. Before they issued the report, witnesses were turning up dead. And then when the House Select Committee started to meet in the late 70s, more people started turning up. Scores of people, they looked at 100 cases of witnesses who died, 30 of them violently, you know, through gunshot throughout that period. And there's only one group that I could think of, the mob, with the intelligence agencies working together to keep the stories from getting out. Oswald was the first witness killed.
And then what do you think of Jack Ruby?
He was a mobster, and he was ordered. Mm-hmm. You got to take this one out. And, of course, if you defy an order, you're dead. So you really don't have a choice.
And then he dies of cancer. Do you think that was an induced cancer, or do we have any evidence of that?
Well, some people have said that. You know, in my mind, it was in 67, well, January 67. They definitely wanted to silence him. Because he wasn't happy. He did know something had happened and that something was going on. And he did tell people that there was a much larger conspiracy than people had any idea. But he didn't give details. So I'm sure they wanted him silenced. But I don't know if the cancer was there or not. Yeah.
Because I know I read the book Dr. Mary's Monkey, and that just blew me away, the connection between Lee Harvey Oswald and cancer. You know what I mean? That was very weird, the whole thing. So, and I know they were working on trying to be able to create cancer in people, according to that book anyway.
The drugs that we know for sure that came out in the 70s House Select Committee reports, they had developed drugs that could simulate a heart attack, but you really, they were murdering people, but it would look as if they had a heart attack. That drug, we know they used that drug. They developed it, and they had the capability of doing that.
Maybe you can speak to the latest thing with these documents that were supposed to be released 25 years after the 1992 congressional orders to do so. I know they've withheld a lot of them. They've redacted some of them. What are your thoughts on that? And do we really need them? Do we have enough information without them?
You know, it would be fantastic if the redactions weren't there. Mm-hmm. Redactions are the parts that are blacked out. And redactions are massive. They're blacking out entire pages. And I don't think it's right. But quite frankly, anything that was really critical would have been destroyed. And in fact, we know Helms and Angleton, the CIA people I mentioned earlier, in 73, they destroyed most of their documents. Now, you have to understand one thing. A lot of the operations, they didn't put into writing. So either they didn't put into writing or it was destroyed in 73 when they were leaving office. And anything that's left over is great to have, though, because if you connect dots and you look at some of these documents and you know something already, you can definitely make connections that will bring out the truth.
So for that reason alone, it would be good to get your hands on those. And now I understand that some of them that they've withheld might be released in the coming year.
Right. I've heard the president said, work on these and get them out. He gave them another 6 months till April to get the rest of the documents out and unredact documents.
So I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens then. So, and you're saying that these four guys, Angleton and Helm and them, were responsible for Bobby Kennedy, too.
Absolutely. I mean, he ran for president, Bobby, in my mind, and a lot of others. Walter Sheridan, his family, were very close to Bobby while he was a former Justice Department official. And he said, we talked, and Bobby really suspected the CIA, and he was going to run. But he couldn't tell anyone unless he was president, because only in that level would he then be able to do something about it. And that was his goal for running, to nail these people.
You have one of your chapters in your book. Chapter 2 is called The Sociopathy Test. Can you speak to that?
Right. Dr. Robert Hare was a PhD in psychology, and he can develop this system for being able to diagnose clinically someone who is a sociopath. You know, we've heard of psychopaths. Sociopath is the same thing. The only difference being, some scientists believe that you become this way, a sociopath, through your genes. You inherit it. And those people would say that you're a psychopath. The ones who don't think you don't get it through your genes, you inherit these horrible characteristics, would be from your family situation, not from your genes, but from your social situation, whether it's your family or your friends. They would call you a sociopath. So a sociopath and a psychopath, the same thing. Mm-hmm. It depends on whether you inherit, if you believe it was inherited through your genes or you picked it up from your family, your upbringing.
From your environment, yeah.
Yeah, your environment.
And so how does that relate to
the
Kennedy assassination?
It relates because in trying to understand the motive of Richard Helms, who was head of the CIA in 66 to 73, but was a very top, high-level person in 63, and James Angleton, we have to try and figure out their psychology. Why would someone do this? And it turns out that we can see quite readily that their motives were power, self-preservation, and rabid anti-communism. And they felt that Kennedy, both Kennedys, were starting to try and make peace with Cuba and with the Russians, with North Vietnam. This is a fact. John planned to pull 1,000 troops, even signed a document to pull 1,000 troops from Vietnam. And this is right before he died. He was opening up avenues to try and make peace with North Vietnam through the French. He was trying to make peace with Castro. He was calling off the CIA to stop the raids on his country. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he was trying to improve relations with Russia in many areas. Mm-hmm. So in the mind of the military, especially the intelligence agencies, rather, he was considered soft on communism. And this, in their minds, was going to lead to the end of our country as we know it. And he had to be stopped. So it was power, self-preservation, and rabid anti-communism that motivated Helms and Angleton and Phillips and E. Howard Hunt. You have to look deeper into their psychology. So by studying their media comments, studying the biography and the autobiographies of these men, you can really develop kind of a profile of what they were like. And then when you match it up with Dr. Hare's sociopath characteristics, man, the match is amazing.
I'm glad that you put a chapter in there on that, because I don't hear that often about that angle of it.
Yeah.
It's interesting, yeah. What motivates them. Your last chapter in the book is about conclusions. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about what conclusions you drew from your research.
In conclusion, well, we have to learn from the past. We have to bring justice and truth to the table. And that means justice for Sirhan, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a parole hearing a year and a half ago. A man stood up who was one of the five people that were wounded when Bobby was shot. And he said, Sirhan couldn't have done it. I was there. He was in the wrong position.
Did they say he had a gun and was he shooting?
He did have a gun and he was shooting. But this person, Paul Schrade, he's 90 years old now, and he stated, no, I was right there. Sirhan was in the wrong location, too far away, at the wrong distance. Uh-huh. All the shots that killed Bobby were from half an inch away. There are powder burns on the back of his head.
Wow.
Someone put the gun right into the back of his head from behind. Sirhan was where you are, okay, 4 feet away. But the parole hearing personnel just threw that out, and they denied parole.
You've studied this. You've written about it. Why is this important to America and to Americans, and why should young people care about this?
Again, the past determines the future in many ways. So you need to understand the past to be able to make the future safe and better for yourself and for your kids and grandkids. That's really important. And also to bring justice, like I said, for Sirhan and the family of Oswald. It affects our relations with the world. We want to be known as a country that is fair and honest and truthful. You know, that we make mistakes, but we can correct them and we can move on. And
I see it also as they got away with that. They got away with those. And they got away with Martin Luther King. Do you see that as the same people? Like that?
I do. I've really studied that quite a bit. And James Earl Ray, he's the same as Oswald and Sirhan. He was definitely framed, fall guy. And they decided, the agency, the rogues, decided to do away with Martin Luther King because he was going to join the Bobby Kennedy campaign. He made it known.
Ah.
He told his people, we've got to help Bobby, he said.
Yeah.
This is in April 4th, he was killed. at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. And there were witnesses that saw James Earl Ray, a couple of blocks from the rooming house at the time he was supposed to have been shooting. Other witnesses saw someone who didn't resemble Ray at all in the bushes with smoke coming out of the bushes if he'd fired a rifle. And so there's so many discrepancies that you could clearly see, especially if you just study the life of James Earl Ray. At the end, when he was picked up, he was told, plead guilty, because if you don't, you're going to get the electric chair. Of course, he pleaded guilty. Then a week later, he changed his mind. Yeah. He said, this is crazy. He said, I wanted to go through the whole trial and everything, but nothing ever came of that.
The only way they could get away with this is because the media is controlled by them. Otherwise, I think we would have more of the truth. But I wanted to ask you, how has writing this book and being, quote, a conspiracy theorist impacted your life, if it has, maybe?
You know, I'm a conspiracy theorist, but if you open up my book on the very first page, it clearly states that I believe there was a conspiracy in the Robert Kennedy, you know, and John Kennedy assassinations. I'm not one of these people who believes, you know, that the moon landing was fake. I don't believe that Elvis is still alive. I'm a historian, and I know, like, for example, Abraham Lincoln says, oh, okay, he was shot by John Wilkes Booth. Five people were hanged. I mean, there was a conspiracy there. Yeah.
Right.
Conspiracies have happened.
Yeah.
And for someone to say, oh, he's a conspiracy theorist, you sound like you're lumping all of these things together, and you can't do that.
Right. And we know that the CIA created that term to keep people from questioning the Warren Commission, so that people would think, oh, they're loony or nutty.
Yeah.
Do you know what the polls show about how many people don't believe what the Warren Commission has told us?
Oh, it's more than half believe that the Warren Commission was a myth.
Well, excellent. I understand you're going to be giving a talk in January at the West Hartford Library. Can you tell us the details of that?
I'm speaking January 16th at the Noah Webster Library in Blueback, West Hartford. It's at 7 p.m. And I'm hoping that we get a good crowd so that we can do some question and answer. I'll bring some books.
Okay, so great. Again, that's January 16th at 7 p.m. at the West Hartford Main Library in downtown in Blueback. Well, I want to thank you again for joining me on the show. Patrick Nolan can get his book, which I would recommend. It's called CIA Rogues and the Killing of the Kennedys, How and Why U.S. Agents Conspired to Assassinate JFK and RFK. So again, thank you, Patrick Nolan, for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Good to be here.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with forensic historian and author Patrick Nolan, discussing his book, CIA Rogues and the Killing of the Kennedys, How and Why U.S. Agents Conspired to Assassinate JFK and RFK. Since this show is dedicated primarily to 9/11 truth, I do have to make the following comments on a point of disagreement with Patrick Nolan. In the preface of his book, he states the following. In 1969, man landed on the moon. In 1977, Elvis died. In 2001, the United States was attacked by terrorists. The 9/11 assaults did not, in any way, shape, or form, involve the CIA. In contrast to these facts, there are conspiracy theorists who mistakenly believe that the moon landing was faked, that Elvis lives, and that 9/11 was an inside job. Now, I get what he's trying to do here, to show that he doesn't believe in every conspiracy theory, but that some conspiracies really do exist and occur. So the moon landing and Elvis aside, the official account of 9/11 is itself a conspiracy theory. And the government has never given any evidence to support its claim that Osama bin Laden and the 19 alleged hijackers had anything to do with 9/11. Rex Toom of the FBI even said so. In 2006, when asked by a reporter from Muckraker magazine why Osama bin Laden was not wanted for 9/11 on his FBI wanted page, Rex Toom replied, because we have no hard evidence linking Osama bin Laden to 9/11. After our interview today, we discussed 9/11, and I gave Patrick some info about it. My hope is that he'll use his research skills to investigate 9/11, and that one day, in the near future, he'll come on the show and discuss it. And just for the record, I don't think 9/11 was an inside job. I think it was an inside-outside job. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people. Power to the people.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. Billionaires feast on $1.5 trillion Trump tax cut, leaves 99% with scraps from their table, and threatens Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. We speak with Dean Baker, formerly an assistant professor of economics at Bucknell University, currently co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and Alex Lawson, executive director, Social Security Works. Oh, yeah, does it, Alex? Is that what you told Washington in the demonstrations that were held?
Social Security certainly does work, and that is one of the things we told them, along with keep your greedy hands off of all of our benefits, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And I am on the Hill right now, and unfortunately, my report is that there wasn't much. I mean, one office actually locked the door to us and made us talk to them through the mail slot in the door. That's Representative Ed Royce from California, through the mail slot of the door. Susan Collins locked her door and refused to hear from anybody, including her constituents from Maine. This is what we're up against when it comes to this tax scam.
Tell us more about what actually happened. Obviously, there was perhaps a national grouping that went to Washington to suggest that the tax bill is not a Christmas gift for us, but rather a lump of coal. Tell us more what happened.
So, yeah, you had hundreds of people come into D.C. from all over, and you had thousands more across the country visiting their representative and their senator's offices. I'm not sure if you saw any of the coverage of a man named Adi Barkin, who has ALS, and he confronted Senator Flake on a plane about how the tax scam was going to hurt him and his family and his child by cutting deeply into Medicaid, by raiding Medicare, by slashing these programs that help keep him alive. And today is his 34th birthday. So a lot of what we were doing was going with Adi from office to office, telling these members and these senators that their vote was not just a vote. It wasn't just a money in a ledger. This is people's lives on the line, and that we are here to make sure they know we're watching them, and we will know how they're voting on this tomorrow.
Well, we're going to talk more with you about the effect on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security a little bit later. But first, Dean, why don't you talk about how most of us are affected by this tax bill, and how is it that it some people have called it a sugar-coated poison pill. What about the sugarcoating? What do people really think they're going to get, especially with change CPI and the repeal of the individual mandate?
Yeah, well, there's not a lot of sugar here. I mean, repeal the individual mandate, this is the mandate that people have to buy health care insurance. According to the Congressional Budget Office, that's going to lead to 13 million fewer people getting health care insurance. And just to be clear, a lot of that is that people who qualify for Medicaid won't get it because they presumably don't realize they would qualify, but the mandate's kind of a kick, you know, okay, people don't like that, I'm not thrilled with it myself, but the point is it gets them to sign up, and then they realize they don't even have to pay anything, they get it free. But we'll have many fewer people getting Medicaid, so, and 13 million people, again, fewer people having insurance, so that's a pretty bad story. The change CPI is a little nerdy, but the way the tax code works now, the brackets are indexed to the consumer price index. The change CPI, not worth going into details here, but it rises somewhat less rapidly, about 2 to 3 tenths of a percentage point a year less rapidly. That sounds trivial, but that's cumulative. So over 10 years, what it means is that the brackets are, say, 2.5% lower, so more people are paying taxes at a higher rate. What really concerns me about that's somewhat of a tax increase for people. But what really concerns me about that is there have been efforts over the years to have Social Security index the chain CPI rather than the overall CPI, which means Social Security benefits would be cut. So again, same story. After 10 years, we'd be looking at Social Security benefits that were 2.5% less, 20 years, 5 or 6% less. That's a fairly big hit to people. So that's, to my view, a big concern. They do have what you might call a little sugar here. There's an expanded child tax credit, good thing. A lot of the people who need it most won't get it because it's not fully refundable. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities did the calculation that for a couple, two-earner couple, two kids, $30,000, they get $800 a year. That's not zero, but, you know, that's not going to hugely change their standard of living. The big point, though, is that at the end of the day, the money, the big money is all going to the very wealthy. A lot of this, you know, people have joked about it, but it really looks like if you're sitting there, how do we write something to put more money in Donald Trump's pocket? A lot of this sure looks that way. So we have a more generous exemption in the estate tax. We have special treatment of real estate, special treatment of golf courses. I mean, this is, you know, again, if you're sitting there, what can we do to make Donald Trump richer? A lot of it looks that way. And again, we could all just laugh at that, except, you know, with the points Alex was making. They're going to turn around. These people are absolutely shameless. They're going to turn around and go, oh, my God, the deficit's bigger, and we're going to have to cut Medicare, Medicaid, maybe Social Security. We'll have to see exactly what's on their block. But that's actually the law. So that's not just Alex and I speculating. That's the law. They could change it. But the law, as it stands now, sets deficit targets. They're exceeding them, and there's automatic cuts if they don't hit those deficit targets. So these are the programs on the chopping block, and that's a real big deal.
Dean Baker, the Republicans, when we last checked in, the tax plan was said to give the top 1% of households roughly a $200,000 tax cut, and the bottom 20% got, whoa, a whopping $50. Now, is that still how it works out? And how do you juxtapose that with their promise, this is a holiday present? Oh, not a holiday, Christmas. That's the only one that matters. It's a Christmas present that's going to stimulate the economy. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And are you all going to thank us? Tell us the real skinny.
Didn't mean to cut you off there. There's some changes. Some make it more tilted towards the rich. Some make it less. So the prior bill, the Senate bill, lowered the top tax rate from 39.6% to 38%. This lowers it to 37%. Again, that might seem trivial, but think about that. You have people that are earning $5, $10 million. So 1% of that, you're talking about $50,000, $100,000 a year. You know, most of us, it wouldn't make that much difference. We got 1 percentage point cut in our taxes, but don't worry, you're not getting it anyhow. You know, the argument, that the one argument that they keep making, that if it were true, then you'd have to take it seriously, that there'd be this flood of investment. They would lead to a huge increase in employment and higher wages. That would sound good to me, except there's very little evidence. Again, this is a very well-studied topic, and it's not just an academic thing. You know, many of us remember back in 1986, big cut in the corporate income tax. We took it down from 46 to 35%. Investment actually fell the next 2 years. So we've been here, we've done that, it doesn't work. The one point I will add, and I think it is important to note, the economy actually is doing pretty well right now. I mean, we're at 4.1% unemployment. We haven't been there since 2000, and wages actually have started to rise recently as the labor markets tighten. So not saying it's a great economy. We have a long, long way to go to make up for the Great Recession, and even longer if we're talking about making up 3 decades of stagnation prior to that. But things are, for the moment, at least going in the right direction. And I think that is important to point out, because I'd hate to have people think, oh, we passed the tax cut, now things turned around. At the moment, things are actually doing pretty well, and they probably will continue to.
Alex Lawson from Social Security Works. This is estimated to take about $400 billion from Medicare in the next 10 years. I would assume similar amounts from other programs. Let's just focus on Medicare first. How would Medicare function under those conditions?
Worse than today. And what you're talking about is just the PAYGO, which is that automatic deficit. It's the law that's in place right now. But I want to make it really clear that that's not all that's at stake here. Paul Ryan has made it super clear Marco Rubio has made it super clear that first on their agenda for next year is to come back and cut as much as they can from Medicare and Medicaid. And again, you don't really have to, like, believe me on this. You can just look at what they tried to do with Trump Care. They're on record. They all voted for it. That was a destruction of Medicaid. $1 trillion destroyed Medicaid, the largest provider of long-term care in this country, and for many people, the only provider of long-term care. In-home care, nursing home care, that's Medicaid. It's for all of us. As well as raiding Medicare for hundreds of billions of dollars. What's at stake is really these programs being able to operate efficiently and to work for us. And that is the crux of what they're doing. They want to destroy these programs. They want to undermine people's confidence in these programs. And then they want to blame it on the programs so that they can get rid of them entirely so that they can throw all of us onto the private insurance market so that our friends in the insurance industry can take in all this money and give them campaign donations. I really am not overstating it when I say that they only have one plan. It's to reach into our pockets, steal our money, and give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. That's what's at stake with this bill.
Dean Baker, I want to ask, well, since we're on the issue of health care in a manner of speaking, and I have a union plan. What's going to happen to me? Are my premiums going to shoot through the roof at this point?
Well, I can't really answer without knowing more specifics about the plan. I mean, most immediately what's affected are the individual markets, both the markets within the exchanges, but individual markets more generally will be affected. Union plans, it is pretty hard to say. Some of the union plans were in financial difficulties for reasons not directly to do with the tax cut. You know, let's put it this way, they aren't going to be helped. But, you know, it's difficult to say how a specific plan will be affected by this.
Well, then let me head to another area, and that is Puerto Rico, which had sought an exemption from new taxes, citing the frail state of its economy nearly 3 months after Hurricane Maria. But no such luck? How the heck are we to understand that?
I mean, there actually are some privileges, preferences in the tax code to encourage businesses to locate in Puerto Rico. One could argue whether those were very effective. They're good things to do. But that's going to hurt them that they're taking them away in this. So, you know, and people are looking for help, Puerto Rico, they're going to get less rather than more with this. And, you know, yeah, it is kind of incredible. I mean, it's still, 3 months now after the hurricanes, and there's still large chunks of the island without electricity, without potable water. It's pretty incredible. I mean, it's part of the United States. I mean, it's bad enough. You think not that people in the developing world should be experiencing that either, but, you know, we know they do. But here, you know, part of the United States, you have people going months without, you know, what we would consider sort of bare necessities.
Dean, the individual tax rates go down from the high of 39 to 37%. That doesn't seem very much, but people have been pointing out that this pass-through agreement, and you'll have to explain why that is, could bring it way down for a lot of people.
Pass-through, this is to my view, just an incredible scam. A pass-through corporation, I mean, to my view, this shouldn't even exist. A pass-through corporation is a corporation that enjoys the benefits of corporate status. So if I have a pass-through corporation and, you know, say it's a fireworks factory and it blows up and takes down a neighborhood, people get hurt, people get killed, well, they can't sue me. They sue my corporation. And if my corporation's out of money, I just go, well, I feel bad for you guys, but, you know, that was the breaks. Well, corporations, part of the quid pro quo was you pay the corporate income tax. Pass-through corporations don't pay any tax, so they just pass the profit on to the individuals. And people talk in this thing, the Republicans have been very clever, and a lot of the media has bought this. They talk about reducing the tax on pass-through corporations. You can't reduce the tax on pass-through corporations. The tax on pass-through corporations is zero. What they're talking about doing is reducing the tax on income from pass-through corporations. And that was the special provision that they put in for real estate and energy industry, that these corporations in particular will be able to pass through income to people like Donald Trump and Senator Corker, who switched his vote, and only pay 20%. So instead of, you know, they're paying 37% on their income, they'll just pay 20%. So that's kind of an incredible scam. And, you know, that they would do this in the light of day, you know, it just shows their contempt for the public. Just, you know, we could stuff our pockets. You don't like it, you know, go somewhere else.
Alex, I'm going to go back to the health question. So people buying health insurance. Now, the repeal of the individual mandate, there are people who currently buy health insurance because they're required by law to do so. And they're expected now, I understand, to go without coverage. So what can you tell us about the health care issues embedded in this tax bill and put a human face on it as you did earlier?
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot here, and I do enjoy going over specifics because it's important. But to Dean's point, this bill is just, it's so overt in what it does. It's nothing in here. If you're not a senator whose vote they need, like Senator Corker, who they're willing to just buy for $1.1 million, and he throws up his hands like, oh, I didn't even know that was in there.
He literally said that, by the way.
Yeah. The grease was there specifically for him. It was a bribe to a senator in a bill to get his yes vote, and they got it. That's how overt we're talking about. So what's at stake for people's health care? Their lives. Their lives are at stake. There are millions of people, children in this country, who rely on Medicaid to keep them alive. And if this tax bill goes through, the devastating cuts to Medicaid that are part and parcel of it will kill people. That's what's at stake here. They're stealing our money. They're stealing our health. Also, some Wall Street banker can get yet another golden yacht, and they're not even hiding it. And you want to know what? They're laughing at us. They're saying, what can you do about it? They're making us talk to them through the mail slots on their doors in this, which is supposed to be the people's building.
Well, you know, Alex, I just want to back up for a minute. And by the way, when I was a kid, you know what we did with the mail slots? We had seltzer bottles that squirted, and we went around to people's mail slots, and we squirted the I shouldn't tell – how did they ever let me pass the bar? But in any event
– I don't know if you're going to be prosecuted on that this many years.
Who knows? But,
well,
you know,
lawyer.
What I also wanted to say, just in case people don't get it, you're telling us they're going to go after Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, sacrosanct benefits virtually. The difference between people who've worked all their lives when they stop working, being out on the street, being in the workhouses of old, a Dickinsonian United States. Why are you so sure? Aren't we just being negative? Aren't we just attacking the Trump? Where does that come from? How are you so sure that that's the upshot of this tax bill?
I just listened to them.
Thank you.
That's what I was thinking.
It is what they say.
Yes.
They say it.
Take that.
They're open
yes.
about it now. But I mean, one thing is that people can go and look at what was in Trump Care. They were pushing this with everything they had, and we defeated them because there's a huge swell of popular outrage that said no. Trump Care and the tax scam are the exact same thing, just in a slightly different order. But they only have one playbook, and this is it. They know they have to go after Social Security probably a little bit later for some technical reasons that we can get into. But Medicare and Medicaid are up right away. And Paul Ryan has said that. Marco Rubio has said that. This is what the plan is. This is what the plan has always been. And you just have to take them at their word on this. And when it comes to stealing our money, they're actually refreshingly honest about it. All sorts of other things, you can't believe them. But when it comes to they're going to come for working families, they're going to take our money, they're going to take our earned benefits, and they're going to give it to their friends on Wall Street. You got to trust them.
Okay, Dean, so let's see how refreshingly honest they are about this whole deal with taxing foreign profits.
Well, as it stands now, there's already kind of a scam in the tax code that with foreign profits, as long as they're kept overseas, companies don't have to pay taxes on them. So you have companies like Apple that have accumulated billions of dollars over the years. They book in Ireland, Ireland being a very low-tax country. And, you know, as long as they ostensibly keep in Ireland, they don't have to pay tax on it. But the idea is, well, at some point they'll bring it back, which generally they do at some point, and then it's subject to tax. What this says is, on the one hand, it lets them bring back what they've kept abroad at a big discount. But then it also says, going forward, if you put your earn your income in Ireland or wherever it might be, you won't have to pay any U.S. tax. And this is really important for two reasons. One is, of course, they actually do have operations in these countries. But the other point is you give them enormous incentive to play games. And, of course, Apple's been doing that, but they'll do it even more because we can't – they developed their next iPhone. Well, they have a division in Ireland. Were they the ones that were responsible for all the money in the iPhone? We have no way of knowing. They're going to say it. How's the IRS going to prove that wrong? So you could be damn sure – that they're going to, I'm picking on Apple here, but it's going to be a lot of companies, that they're going to say, oh, yeah, all our profits, that came from Ireland, that came from Bahamas, that came from Bermuda. That wasn't from the United States. We don't have to pay tax on it. And needless to say, they'll get away with that. So they're looking at a very big corporate tax cut. In addition, I mean, the law, they're lowering it from 35% to 21%, but this treatment of foreign profits is just inviting them to reduce their taxes quite a bit further.
And, of course, there's the projection that 13 million fewer Americans are projected to have health coverage. So you're both activists. You're both activists. What can be done? The die seems to be cast. Where do we go from here? How do we roll back what will influence an entire generation? And as Alex so brilliantly describe for us, the lives that will be taken as a result of these catastrophic windfalls for the rich on the backs of the poor, who are the ones who create the wealth.
Decision. These people made a decision. I'm saying these people, the Republicans in Congress, they know this is hugely unpopular. They read the polls. I mean, that's why they're there. They read polls. They do know that. It's hugely unpopular, but what they're hearing from their donors is, you have to do this for us. And their bet is, okay, they're going to give us the money for the next election, and if we don't win, we're going to get $1 million-plus salaries as lobbyists. So in a certain sense, they don't care. So we have to make it so that all of them are out on the street as soon as possible. And the story in Alabama, you know, people really should be very happy about that. That's a huge deal. A Democrat getting elected in Alabama is kind of amazing. And, you know, needless to say, they all saw that. They all saw that, and they know that pretty much all of them could be beat. And, you know, again, we will yell at the Democrats because we can't count on them to do the right thing. But the point is, if you send a lot of these guys packing for doing this, and then their efforts on Medicaid and Medicare that, you know, we know where they're going to try, we could stop that.
And yeah, Alex, give us some of that fire and fury and maybe some Celsa bottles right through their mail slots.
That is what it's going to take, seltzer bottles in the mail slots. What that is going to look like is we have to never feel despair at a loss on something like this. We have to fight till the absolute end. We have to make them fight for every inch. And we have to remember that we never lose unless we forget what we're fighting for. And we take this directly into 2018. We don't pause for a minute. We don't pause for a minute. We take that fire, that rage, that outrage that these billionaires are stealing our money and their lackeys in Washington, D.C. are doing their bidding, and we come for every single one of them. What Alabama said is that not a single Republican is safe. You look at the margin that what Trump won Alabama by, what Republicans usually win Alabama by, and you tell me what district is safe if the Republicans can't win a Senate seat in Alabama. You tell me what district is safe when you look at the election returns from Virginia. We take this to every single district. we take this to every single legislator who voted to rob the people so that their billionaire buddies can buy another yacht. That is what we have to do. And that, after we take power, then we tax the rich. Then we raise taxes on those billionaires who stole our money. And we take that money and we expand Social Security. We expand Medicare to cover everyone in this country. We build a country and a future that we believe in. That is the plan. That is the only plan going forward.
But, Alex, people are taken to the streets this week, it seems. Shouldn't that have been last week, the week before that? This has been very quiet. Don't we really need to go out on the streets and have some civil disobedience from now until forever?
We do. Let me tell you one thing. We were out. We were here last week. We were here the week before. The people are here. This is not a conspiracy. The corporate media are some of the biggest benefactors, the seven corporations who own almost all of the media, not truth tellers like you, but all of the corporate media. They didn't want to tell the story about what is actually in the tax scam because they're the benefactors of the tax scam. So we not only have to get out in the streets, which we are doing, but we have to get our stories out there. We have to tell people, remind them that they're not alone. I always say the most radical act you can take is to get organized, to stand with your neighbors, to stand with your allies, to raise your voices together, because when we do that, we can't be defeated.
So we're going to just give Dean Baker, also an activist, where do you go from here? How do you proselytize, organize in the weeks and months to come, just like our wonderful firebrand Alex Lawson is telling us? The people have been there. We will continue to build and move and shake. And you, Dean Baker?
Yeah, well, people have to come out. They have to see that there are other people together. I mean, you know, this has been ongoing. I mean, we defeated their efforts to undermine, to repeal Obamacare, and that was because a lot of people came out. You had town halls. You had members of Congress hiding. I mean, what Alex is talking about with they have to talk to their members of Congress or senators through the mail slot. Well, that's outrageous on the one hand, but that's because these people are scared. They don't have the support of their constituents, and it's important people come out and see that there's other people who share their views, share their anger. And again, we won with Obamacare, and we could do that again on this. It's going to be a big effort. It's not going to be a single day. It's not going to be one protest. It's going to be a lot. It has to be a sustained effort. But I feel pretty confident. I mean, the story in Alabama, as Alex said, that was remarkable. Who would have thought a Democrat would win the Senate in Alabama? And I'm in Washington. People were laughing at that just 3 weeks ago, a month ago, and it happened. So these people know that they're not safe, and they're going to be defeated. And
indeed,
again, the important thing is that people come out and they see that there are others who share their views.
And with leadership like Dean Baker from the Center for Economic Policy Research and the fiery, wonderful Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works. We're going to hear a lot more from both of them in the weeks and months to come. And from William Barber, who is building a national poor people's campaign. So there's going to be a lot of things for us to do. Thank you both. Thank you both. We will prevail. We will make it so. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
It's important to understand that Amendment 2 was never about people. It was about conduct.
The court said, voters of Colorado, you may have adopted this, but it deprives a targeted group of people of basic constitutional rights, and that can't stand.
Because of this ruling, there will be no logical or reasonable explanation as to why pedophilia, bestiality, bigamy, and polygamy cannot be denied to anybody that claims it.
We're not trying to destroy American values. We want to uphold American values.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine, I'm Lucia Chappell. Bermuda backtracks on court-ordered marriage equality, Indonesia's top court rejects criminalizing unwed sex, and Colorado cake case recalls Supreme Amendment two-step. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending December 16, 2017. Bermuda lawmakers have made it the first country in the world to overturn court-ordered marriage equality. Voters in the U.S. state of California did that at the ballot box in November 2008 when they passed Proposition 8, which was trashed by the U.S. Supreme Court 4.5 years later. The Domestic Partnership Act, which has now passed both houses of Bermuda's legislature, overturned a May Supreme Court ruling that had opened marriage to same-gender couples. The measure instead offers those couples less than equal partnership status. The marriages of couples who've wed since the May ruling, however, including the marriage of the original plaintiffs, Winston Godwin and Greg DeRoche, will still be legal. The Progressive Labor Party, which took power in July, was responding to pressure from religious conservatives and their congregations, who harshly criticized the Supreme Court decision and held several demonstrations to protest it. In response to criticism from human rights groups, government officials pointed to the granting of legal status to same-gender couples via the domestic partnership provision.
The generally self-governing British Overseas Territory is located in the North Atlantic Ocean and has about 65,000 residents. The island, of course, is a popular travel destination and hosts up to 10 times that number of people every year. So the new law was vigorously opposed by the cruise ship industry. Many operators are registered in Bermuda and had already started booking wedding cruises for lesbian and gay couples. Because it's a British overseas territory, the law must still be given royal assent on behalf of the British monarch. In this case, that will be through Governor John Rankin. Royal assent of territorial laws is almost always a formality, but Rankin is feeling heat from some quarters who don't want such a regressive law to be signed on behalf of the Queen. It should also be noted that Bermuda's Supreme Court is not the highest judicial body in the country. That distinction goes to the Court of Appeal, although there's even an appeals process beyond that, avenues the opponents of marriage equality apparently decided not to take. A case filed by another same-gender couple could also begin working its way up the judicial ladder in Bermuda that could eventually lead to the new Domestic Partnership Act itself being overturned by court order. As we like to say around here, stay tuned.
Indonesia's top judicial body, its constitutional court, has rejected an effort to make sex outside of marriage punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Since lesbian and gay couples are not allowed to marry in the world's most populous Muslim nation, that would have outlawed same-gender sex altogether. The narrow 5-4 ruling turned down the petition of a conservative religious group, the Family Love Alliance, which had argued that Indonesia is being overrun by immorality. Because there are no specific laws in Indonesia criminalizing same-gender sex, the court ruled that accepting the petition would have required the creation of new statutes in the country's penal code, and that was the responsibility of lawmakers. Queer Indonesians have endured a wave of hostility in the past few years, stoked by inflammatory public statements from government officials and religious leaders. Police have frequently raided gay clubs and private parties, charging those arrested under Indonesia's broad anti-pornography laws. Andreas Harsono of Human Rights Watch said the ruling won't stop the reality of those routine raids. Just this week, 10 men, who were among some 140 people detained in the raid in May of a Jakarta sauna popular with gay men, were sentenced to 3 years in prison.
As we previously reported, gay and lesbian couples in Australia won't be able to walk down the aisle under the recently enacted marriage equality law until January 9th. The country's marriage statutes require a 30-day waiting period after any couple declares its intention to wed. However, a few same-gender couples have been granted special exemptions to marry sooner than that. 31-year-old Lauren Price and 29-year-old Amy Laker became Australia's first same-gender couple to legally wed on December 16th when they tied the knot in Sydney. They'd already planned a wedding ceremony at the British consulate before Aussie lawmakers opened marriage to same-gender couples, and Price's family, who live in the UK, would only be able to attend if the wedding took place this week. The couple was granted an exemption on financial grounds, citing the prohibitive travel costs of the close relatives.
53-year-old Cass Willow has been waiting 17 years for the right to marry her 56-year-old partner, Heather Richards. The pair are scheduled to wed on December 18th at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Center in Melbourne, where Willow has been receiving care for terminal breast cancer.
Another couple, 30-year-old Stephanie Dybal and 32-year-old Megan Stapleton, will marry in regional Victoria next week after they were also granted an exemption. The couple had booked their wedding for December 21st more than a year ago when they grew impatient for lawmakers to make it legal. Stapleton told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation,
"We got engaged in 2012, so quite a while ago, and we waited and waited, and we got a bit tired of waiting and thought we're not going to wait around anymore for them to change the law. Let's just have a wedding, and we can sort out the legals when they finally get round to it."
They expect more than 65 guests, some of whom are coming from overseas or out of state.
But a pair of unidentified lesbians in Perth could become the first same-gender couple in Australia to divorce. They married in 2015 at the consulate of an unidentified European country where marriage was legal. But things didn't work out. They discovered that it was extremely challenging to divorce because neither was a resident of that European country. But since the new Australian law also recognizes the marriages of same-gender couples legally performed elsewhere, their homeland now recognizes not only the couple's marriage at the consulate, but also their eligibility to file for divorce.
In other news, the U.S. Supreme Court decided on December 11th not to review the workplace discrimination case of a Georgia lesbian. The justices left in place a lower court ruling against Jamaica Evans, whose Lambda legal attorneys had argued that sexual orientation discrimination in the workplace violates Title VII of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. Lower courts have been divided on the issue, making it likely that the Supreme Court will eventually hear a similar case. In April, a Chicago-based federal appeals court found that Title VII, which bans bias based on race, color, religion, national origin, and sex, does forbid workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation. The U.S. Equal Opportunity Commission, an independent federal agency charged with enforcing Title VII, has argued since the start of the second Obama administration in 2012 that bias against LGBT workers violates that statute. The Trump administration reversed that argument in a case before a New York federal appeals court in July, claiming that Title VII does not protect those workers. Legal analysts believe that the refusal of the justices to hear the Evans case was not a rejection of the merits of her case. They seemingly prefer to let other lawsuits involving LGBT workplace bias percolate for a bit longer in lower federal courts before taking on the issue.
And finally, in a special election this week to fill the seat of historically homophobic Senator Jeff Sessions, vacated when he took the Attorney General's job in the Trump administration, voters did what they haven't done in more than two decades and elected a Democrat. Doug Jones defeated far-right Republican Roy Moore by more than 20,000 votes. Moore has argued for the recriminalization of same-gender sex and was twice removed as the state's Supreme Court Chief Justice for thumbing his nose at federal law. The second time, it was for telling state officials to ignore the marriage equality ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court. Moore claimed during the closing days of the campaign that opposition to his candidacy was being led by LGBT people. He should have been more concerned about African-American women who led the charge against him at the ballot box. And Doug Jones is, especially by Southern standards, a fairly progressive Democrat. The Advocate reported on December 16th that Jones, in fact, has an out-and-proud gay son named Carson. The senator-elect not only supports a woman's right to choose, but apparently transgender rights. Some evidence of that came in a video posted to YouTube in October, during which he condemned the Trump administration's withdrawal of Obama-era guidelines to protect transgender students, and also Trump's attempt to ban military service by qualified transgender enlistees. Moore, on the other hand, has refused to concede the election and chose to post a YouTube video of his own late this week with what some critics have called nothing more than a doomsday screed.
We are indeed in a struggle to preserve our republic, our civilization, and our religion. Abortion, sodomy, and materialism have taken the place of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We've redefined marriage and destroyed the basis of family, which is the building block of our country.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending December 16th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
There's been a lot of noise in the air this year. You might even call it sound and fury. You can help defeat the noise by joining This Way Out's year-end campaign at thiswayout.org.
Last time on This Way Out...
I'm here at the Supreme Court because I respectfully declined to create a custom cake that would celebrate a view of marriage in direct conflict with my faith's core teachings.
This is about freedom for LGBT people to live full lives in public and not in constant fear that they will be denied basic service just for who they are.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Last week's U.S. Supreme Court hearings on the infamous Colorado wedding cake case brought to our minds the landmark 1996 Supreme Court ruling that first found gays, lesbians, and bisexuals worthy of equal protection under the Constitution. Colorado was ground zero back then, too, and there were some interesting political parallels. Similar to the push for so-called religious freedom legislation today was the conservatives' darling DOMA. The now-defunct Defense of Marriage Act was being debated in Congress and about to be signed by then-President Bill Clinton. In this flashback of our May 27, 1996 report, you'll even hear a reference to now-President Donald Trump's attorney, Jay Sekulow, who had helped defend Colorado's right to discriminate. Here's how co-anchor Greg Gordon and I told the story that week.
For the first time in the history of the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that gay and lesbian Americans are entitled to equal protection under the law.
We got a good decision, folks. It's going to have an impact for many, many years to come. And we all made it possible here in Colorado.
In its most important ruling impacting lesbian-gay rights in the past decade, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Colorado's Amendment 2. The voter-passed referendum, which prohibited statewide anti-discrimination protections for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, attempted to amend the Colorado Constitution in order to overturn protections that had been passed in the cities of Denver, Boulder, and Aspen.
The first judicial shot against Amendment 2 was fired by Denver District Court Judge Jeffrey Bayless in January 1993, 2 months after 53% of Colorado voters passed the initiative.
Do the plaintiffs have a reasonable probability, given all of the law that the court has examined, of proving that Amendment 2 is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt? Yes. The motions for preliminary injunction are granted, and the defendants, the governor of the state of Colorado and the attorney general of the state of Colorado, are enjoined from declaring Amendment 2 in force and are enjoined from enforcing Amendment 2 until further order of court.
Bayless eventually made the injunction permanent, and on appeal, the Colorado Supreme Court agreed that Amendment 2 violated the state constitution. Finally, on May 20th, 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case entitled Romer v. Evans that the measure violated the U.S. Constitution.
Writing for the 6-3 majority, Reagan appointee Justice Anthony Kennedy said Amendment 2 was contrary to the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause because it limited the ability of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals to equally participate in the political process. In his 14-page ruling, Kennedy dismissed the state's argument that anti-discrimination protections gave gays, lesbians, and bisexuals special rights. He wrote that Amendment 2 unfairly identifies persons by a single trait and then denies them protection across the board, an act he called unprecedented in our jurisprudence. We must conclude that Amendment 2 classifies homosexuals not to further a proper legislative end, but to make them unequal to everyone else. This Colorado cannot do. A state cannot so deem a class of persons a stranger to its laws.
That rebuke was received with indignation by Colorado Attorney General Gail Norton, who argued in support of Amendment 2 before the Supreme Court.
The court's decision is insulting to the Colorado voter. It mocks the democratic process.
Boulder Attorney Gene Dubofsky, who argued the case against Amendment 2 before the court, had this response to the charge that the decision undermined the democratic process.
The court said, voters of Colorado, you may have adopted this, but it deprives a targeted group of people of basic constitutional rights, and that can't stand.
The court's three most conservative members, Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, and Chief Justice William Rehnquist, issued a bitter dissenting opinion. Citing the last major Supreme Court ruling involving lesbian rights, the 1986 Bowers v. Hardwick decision, which upheld the state of Georgia's right to criminalize consensual adult homosexual sexual activity, Scalia wrote, "If it is rational to criminalize the conduct, surely it is rational to deny special favor and protection to those with a self-avowed tendency or desire to engage in the conduct. Amendment 2 is designed to prevent piecemeal deterioration of the sexual morality favored by a majority of Coloradans. Striking it down is an act not of judicial judgment, but of political will."
The court's decision in the case elicited predictably favorable response from the major U.S. lesbian-gay rights organizations, although most cautioned that the ruling does not guarantee gay and lesbian rights in America, but simply ensures that states cannot pass laws to deny them specific rights.
Lesbians and gay men are exactly where they were before, which is without protection.
The Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund's Beatrice Dorn.
Essentially, where we are is we are free to seek, by legislative means, protections against the discrimination which we suffer.
Pacifica Radio's Verna Avery Brown asked the Human Rights Campaign's David Smith about the role of the Romer v. Evans decision in the broader gay and lesbian civil rights struggle.
Now, this ruling strikes down Colorado's ban on laws to protect homosexuals from discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. Does it basically give them full protection as citizens, or is it an area that's not covered under this?
The important thing to understand with today's ruling is that gay people can still be fired in 41 states in the United States simply based on their sexual orientation with no legal recourse. Most people are shocked when they learn that. This court decision is a welcome decision in light of the congressional gay bashing that has taken place in the last couple of weeks. The anti-gay marriage bill that is introduced in Congress 2 weeks ago, and they had hearings on it last week, 2 years before any law will manifest in Hawaii that could actually make it possibly legal for gay people to get married, begs the question, don't they have anything better to do? the extreme right, which continues to attack gay people across the country, is shifting their tactics. They're setting their sights more on state legislative battles. They're dealing with the gay marriage issue. They are attacking us on different fronts. But it's important to understand this is a long-term struggle in the various arenas where we will be working. That's in the courts. That's in the Congress, that's in state legislatures. It's important that everybody stay involved and keep their eye on the prize.
That was the Human Rights Campaign's David Smith talking with Verna Avery Brown.
On the 700 Club, a regular TV program sponsored and hosted by the Christian Coalition's Pat Robertson, Jay Sekulow, chief counsel for the coalition's legal arm, the American Center for Law and Justice, said he hoped the black community realized that homosexuals have now been equated with racial minorities, which he said is not factually true.
Will Perkins, chair of Colorado for Family Values, which engineered the placement of Amendment 2 on the state ballot and campaigned for its passage, repeated the standard argument used to promote the measure.
You see, it's important to understand that Amendment 2 was never about people. It was about conduct. And to give a conduct that is considered to be reprehensible by the majority of people and put it into some kind of a preferred status, in my view, is an extremist action.
Today's decision could so deeply impact our entire culture that there may actually be an outcry from the people for Congress to impeach some of these Supreme Court justices.
Perkins said he's spoken with other groups around the U.S. that supported Amendment 2 and received what he called a lot of exciting interest in the impeachment idea. Boulder activist Rick Sendo said Perkins had taken the word sore loser to new heights, noting that impeachment requires evidence of a criminal act. He termed Perkins' statements extraordinary evidence of his and CFV's extremism in their fundamental hostility toward the American system of government.
Kevin Thibodeau, who founded Colorado for Family Values but left the organization earlier this year under a veil of suspicious accusations, also repeated the religious rights argument that protecting gays and lesbians from discrimination would open the floodgates to moral destruction.
What they have opened to this nation is anything goes. Because of this ruling, there will be no logical or reasonable explanation as to why pedophilia, why bestiality, why bigamy and polygamy cannot be denied to anybody that claims it.
But Evan Wolfson, director of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund's Marriage Project, said the Supreme Court's Amendment 2 decision could favorably impact the current campaign for same-gender marriage. Wolfson pointed specifically to the court's conclusion that no legitimate government purpose was served by denying gays and lesbians equal protection, commenting that it was exactly the argument we are making against the radical proposal to create an unprecedented federal definition of marriage. Whatever Congress's power to run federal programs, there can be no legitimate or rational purpose in such a sweeping creation of a caste system in marriage. There are also four federal appeals court cases dealing with the issue of open gays and lesbians in the military, and Michelle Beneke of the Service Members Legal Defense Network described the Amendment 2 ruling as incredibly important to all gay and lesbian litigation. For the first time, gays and lesbians are recognized as citizens under the Constitution.
Supporters of lesbian rights held open-air rallies across Colorado to celebrate the Supreme Court ruling. In Denver, an estimated 1,500 people rallied at the steps of the state capitol, where Richard Evans, the Denver city administrator who became the lead plaintiff in the case, did a cartwheel in front of the steps. One of the speakers, Rabbi Stephen Foster, said that the issue transcends queer rights. "I hope everybody here is not gay or lesbian," he told the crowd. "This issue goes way beyond the gay and lesbian community. But this decision only means that the law has not changed. This is not the time to extend the arm of friendship. This is still a war, and it has not been won."
But in Colorado Springs, home of Colorado for Family Values, the executive director of the anti-Amendment 2 group Ground Zero offered an olive branch to anti-gay groups. Frank Whitworth suggested that civilized discussions of the issues be held to avoid contentious rhetoric. "Our job is to let people in the community know who we really are," he said. We are part of the community. We have always been part of the community, but for years we refused to admit who we are.
Colorado's Governor Roy Romer, who had urged defeat of Amendment 2 during the 1992 campaign and is the only governor to veto anti-same-gender marriage legislation this year, said he hoped for reconciliation among the battling partisans.
Now, I know the issue of sexual orientation is one on which many disagree, but I make this appeal. Let's find out how we can live together with our differences rather than spend our time dividing over this issue.
Priscilla Inkpen, a Boulder County minister, says she was a bit surprised to be thinking about how the pro-Amendment 2 forces must be feeling, and also stressed the need for reconciliation.
But I really want to say that to the people who feel like they've lost today, that we're not trying to destroy the family. We're not trying to destroy American values. We want to uphold American values. We want to have families and be accepted by our families and be able to live in this society. And that's what this case has been about.
Colorado, Colorado, when the world leaves you shivering and the blizzard blows, when the snow flies and the night falls, there's a light in the window and a place called home at the end.
Returning from that May 1996 flashback to the waning days of 2017, we've asked the Therapy Sisters to offer this seasonal greeting.
Happy whatever you're having. Hope that the season is bright. I'll wish that for you all your best dreams come true if they're politically correct. Cultural, gender-neutral, non-sectarian, unambiguous, ovo-lacto, vegetarian, nature-loving, sweet agrarian, non-polluting, mass-appealing, anti-looting, non-fur-wearing, all-inclusive celebration!
Unless, of course, you don't want to, because we don't want this to be a high-pressure situation. This is your holiday.
Happy whatever to you!
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from John Dyer V and Michelle Yeader, produced by Steve Pride. Bob Marley, Judy Collins, and the Therapy Sisters performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible, especially during our Defeat the Noise year-end campaign at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KYAQ Lincoln County, Oregon, for NAG Nippon, Queensland, WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Two leading radicals, Karl Marx and the anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, famously clashed in the 1860s. They bickered and fought and heaped invective on each other, and as a consequence, the International Workingmen's Association, known as the First International, split in two in 1872. Hostility and tension between socialists and anarchists continue to this day, and Mark Lear, for one, wonders whether it could have been different. Lear, a history professor at Simon Fraser University, has compared the backgrounds and ideas of Marx and Bakunin and has found many similarities, similarities ignored by or unknown to many who've written about and analyzed the momentous breakup of the First International. Lear has also examined the temperaments of these two men for clues into why they disliked and distrusted each other so much. Lear, who wrote a biography called Bakunin, The Creative Passion, has come out with a new pamphlet about Marx and Bakunin. The pamphlet's title is Divide and Conquer or Divide and Subdivide, How Not to Refight the First International. When Mark Lear joined me from British Columbia, I asked him what the First International was.
The First International was an attempt of a number of left-wing and communist and working class and anarchist political groups to come together to create an organization that would help workers across the world build a new kind of solidarity. It was started in 1864. Its first meeting was in London, and its first Congress, where they had delegates from mostly in Europe, was held a couple of years later in Geneva.
And what were the roles of Karl Marx and Mikhail Bakunin within the First International?
The two organizers and radicals represented different wings and different ideas about how the socialist revolution was going to come about. Although I think the differences have really been overstated, but what we see in the First International is a deep feud between Bakunin and his followers and the Proudhon followers that were allied with him, and with a small group of Marxists in there. And they used, and anyone that's been to a co-op meeting or a left-wing meeting or a strata council meeting or, you know, a departmental meeting of some kind knows how these things can develop, and they can become very nasty long after everyone has forgotten what the original battles were all about. And so one of the things that happened was the two different sides used some small differences on small matters to become trigger points to engage in a kind of schismatic infighting.
And this infighting climaxed with a final split between the two men, between their two factions, at the Hague Congress of the First International in 1872. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, you know, it was, again, very typical of the kinds of things, but basically the two sides lined up and held various votes on matters, and voting goes back and forth. And finally, however, Marx and his allies win a couple of crucial votes, and they use that as a way to kick out Bakunin and the Bakuninists. They then move the International's headquarters to New York City, so virtually nobody could get to the next Congress, and the whole thing pretty much wraps up by 1876. So a bitter irony for the left as this attempt to forge a new solidarity, greater unity, dissolves into factional fights, into feuding. One side takes its marbles and goes home. The anarchists do create another international shortly after that, which continues for some years. And of course, in the 1880s, there was a revival of something called the Second International, which was very much an international of social democratic parties. It does not have the same broad range of left-wing members and ideas in it.
So in this pamphlet you have written for PM Press, it's called Divide and Conquer, or Divide and Subdivide, with a question mark, How Not to Refight the First International. You actually go back in time. You look at the upbringings and the years of youth and young adulthood of both Karl Marx and Mikhail Bakunin, Michael Bakunin, and it's very revealing, and it tells me, at least as one reader of this pamphlet, a lot about who these men were, where they came from, and how in some ways similar they were. And I think that's part of your point, is that these two men actually were more similar than one might think, based on everything we've heard about the antagonism between them. So let's start with Bakunin. You write that Bakunin's family was part of the Russian nobility. Does that mean, Mark, that his family was rich, was part of the idle rich?
No, it doesn't. One of the things that's happened in this long feud between anarchists and Marxists, you know, from 1864 even to the present, is that both sides are quick to point at the other as being absolutely, you know, unrepresentative of any kind of working class or real left-wing movement, by saying that, in this case, that Bakunin was not a worker, but was an aristocrat. And it is true, but his family was not in the circles of the Tsar. Their estate was pretty far from Moscow and from St. Petersburg. And it did not mean what we tend to think of when we think of aristocrats. You know, we think of Queen Victoria, we think of the Tsar, but that's not what their life was like. The family did control the lives of about 2,000 serfs, but that did not confer huge wealth. This was a family that had more money than peasants, absolutely, but had to pay strict attention to housekeeping, had to keep strict attention to the books in order to keep going. When you look at the letters of Bakunin's father, it's filled with, you know, we're not sure if we're going to make it this month. You know, we really are having a very difficult time making ends meet. It did mean that they had the luxury of educating the children. And so Michael and his sisters and his brothers got very good educations, much of it done by tutors that were brought into the home. They were given the training appropriate for gentlemen and ladies, but it was a training that was very instrumental in the sense that it was to prepare the men to step into careers in the army or as professionals or perhaps as people able to manage the estate, and to provide the Sisters of Michael Bakunin with the graces and skills and personal characteristics that would allow them to make good marriages. So this was not a family rolling in wealth, although it was certainly enough to send Bakunin off to school, where he went to a military academy and took up service in the Tsar's army. But he was not one of the idle rich in that sense.
So what about Karl Marx's parents? Now, obviously, he grew up in Germany, not in Russia. Where did his parents fall within the ranks of German society, and how important was education in Marx's family, you know, when he was a kid?
Marx's family was very similar to Bakunin's. They were not aristocrats, but his father was a lawyer. He had vineyards that he ran. So they had enough wealth to educate the children, enough social status that Marx's father would meet with local politicians and have some interest in some political sway, as did Bakunin's father, but not enough to guarantee careers, not enough to allow them to stop working and simply live off the income produced by workers. That was not the situation at all. What is interesting to me is, of course, both sides have looked at the parents of Bakunin and of Marx to say, we can dismiss either of them, depending on your side, as being petty bourgeois elements. That cuts both ways, I think, and it is easy for both sides to overestimate the class position of Bakunin and Marx. So I wanted to pay some attention to that, to say that they were, not unlike rebels that we see all over the place. If you look up the makeup, for example, of the Students for a Democratic Society, the very title, they were university students that had some access to education, whether underground, very similar. It's not true of all organizations, of course, but it's not a surprise that many people of the left do come from backgrounds where they at least have some exposure to education. It's pretty difficult to work all day and then go home and become an expert in the arcane matters of political economy that we need to think about on the left.
Mark Lear is his name. He's professor in the Department of History at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, and he's author of Divide and Conquer, or Divide and Subdivide: How Not to Refight the First International. And he's also the author of a biography of Bakunin, Michael Bakunin, called Bakunin, the Creative Passion. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Bakunin, like Marx, was the oldest of the male children in his family. And you said that he was sent to he went to a military academy. So I understand expectations were placed on young Michael that he would develop into some kind of a military officer. How did he do in school at that academy?
Well, he was not a great student. His passion for rebellion surfaced early, though not in episodes of organizing resistance among his fellow cadets, but that kind of passive-aggressive behavior that is often how people who don't have much power respond. He was, like many students, slow at turning in his assignments, didn't do very well on many of his exams. He was considered to be very bright, and if only he would apply himself, the theory went, he would do very well at that. The point of going to military academy was not just to become a soldier, but to enlist in the army, with any luck, have a, perhaps a good war, if such a thing is possible, and it certainly was for officers. It meant, escaping and acquitting yourself with some honor, so that you would be rewarded by the system for playing that important role in it. So the idea was not to become a career officer, but to be exposed to the circles of power through your service, and in that way actually add to the family income. But it didn't work out. He did some military service, but finally just went AWOL, just left. And his family later then had to scramble and say, well, he was sick, he wasn't well, that's why he's here. He may have had something of a breakdown. It wasn't the case. He was just sick to death of military life, sick to death of the discipline, the pettiness of it. In that sense, we can look to some of his personality leading to his ideas about anarchism, about freedom, and lack of discipline imposed from above.
And Marx, as I understand, he was expected, or I guess his parents hoped that he would engage in the study of law. He went to the University of Bonn in Germany, where he studied law. How did that go?
Not so well. He again was more interested in writing poetry and in drinking and in dueling. You know, it's the 19th century equivalent of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And so was Bakunin, of course. Both of them, lots of their early correspondence, letters back home saying, you know, trying really hard, working really hard, I could do better if you would just send me more money. It didn't fool anybody. As fathers, both of their fathers write back saying, look, we sent you a pile of money. Most people could live for a year or two. You seem to have burned through it all in about 4 months. Maybe you should apply yourself more carefully. So these are some of the parallels, even at a very early age, between the two men. And I stress the parallels because our sense of them, based only on their feuds in the First International, is that they must have been, you know, so very different, that they represented very different approaches to political and economic questions. And they really don't. I think that they have much more in common, which is not surprising given that they had similar backgrounds. And the similarities in their upbringings, in their educations, and their early move first into Hegelian philosophy as a way to make sense of the world, and then into politics and into working class left-wing politics, so very similar that I had to stop and say, so what exactly was the huge difference between them? Why couldn't they get along? Why didn't they become, you know, the hottest duo in the pamphleteering world, you know, until, say, Gilbert and Sullivan or some other famous team, you know?
G.W.F. Hegel, an immensely influential philosopher who, as you began to suggest, influenced both Bakunin and Marx and so many other people of their generation and subsequent generations. Which ideas and beliefs of Hegel most appealed to Marx and to Bakunin?
I think to both of them, what was so appealing about Hegel was he presented for the first time the idea that change, not stasis and stability, was the human condition. If you think about the time in which Hegel is writing, a time when, you know, Europe is changing so drastically, when the economies are in the middle of that shift from hundreds of years of feudalism to this new industrial capitalism that changes everywhere, that doesn't sit very well if you are a king and want to hold with the divine right of kings that says, you know, your family has been on the throne forever and should be on the throne forever. So Hegel, by suggesting that it was change that marked human history, opened up a whole world. Alexander Herzen once said that Hegel gave us the algebra for revolution. I don't think it was so much that Hegel said, look, this is the forward path, this is what we need to do, but that he opened up the world of possibilities. And both of them, as did many others, grabbed onto that. Hegel also made it clear that the way the world looked right now and need not be permanent, and that conflict, rather than something that should be stifled, was in fact necessary for humanity to progress. The other thing that Hegel started to do, and something he doesn't get much credit for, was he started to suggest that the world needed to be understood not in the realm of ideas, but in the material realm. Now, Hegel is often thought of as somebody who thought that it was only ideas that transformed the world, that we would get ideas and we would see them clearly and then we would enact them and change. But in fact, it is Hegel who is reading Adam Smith, for example, and that influence saying, look, you know, we need to understand not just the big picture of great men and great ideas, but the other world where most of us spend most of our lives, that is to say at work, to understand society. Now, Marx gave a very critical interpretation of Hegel to say this is all about thought, but Marx actually knew better. He was exaggerating in the way that academics do to make some valid and useful points. But the reality is, for both of them, the turning away from simply studying ideas within that role, realm of intellectual history and looking at the practical world, the material world, the conflicts between classes was absolutely crucial to their development as political thinkers.
Yeah, abstract analysis was far from enough for Hegel and for Bakunin and for Karl Marx. Mark Lear is my guest. He teaches history at Simon Fraser University. And he is the author of Bakunin, The Creative Passion, and Red Flags and Red Tape, The Making of a Labor Bureaucracy. We are talking about a new pamphlet he's put out. It's published by PM Press, and it's called Divide and Conquer, or Divide and Subdivide, How Not to Refight the First International. And it's about Marx and Bakunin and their similarities and differences and what might explain the antagonism between the two that culminated when the International Working Men's Association, or the First International, split in two in 1872 with really immense and long-lasting reverberations. I'm C.S. Song, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Bakunin, he moved to Moscow, I believe. He studied some philosophy, and then he actually goes to Germany. He moves from Russia to Germany. He goes to the University of Berlin in 1840. What prompted his move from Moscow to Berlin?
Well, his official reason, the reason he gave his parents when he was asking them for money, was to say, you know, I think I would like to be a philosopher. I'm sure his parents recoiled in horror. It wasn't like that was any getting a degree in philosophy. It wasn't much more of a job opportunity than it may be today, I suppose. But he said, look, I need to go to Germany. That's where the hot stuff is happening. That's where it's exciting. And I promise I'll do really well. I'll buckle down because this is what I really want to study, not military ballistics and logistics. So let me go there and do that. And they said, I'm okay, fine. We'll take a chance on this. And he does go there. And he's got some interesting classmates. Max Stirner was one of them. And this may be a name that some of our listeners know. Soren Kierkegaard was another person in one of his classes. And Frederick Engels was there. So that's a pretty high-powered cadre to be in seminars with and probably drinking with after class. Marx was there as well, but he was busy working away on his thesis. So that Bakunin and Marx didn't actually meet while they were both in Berlin. But that was his motivation to go there. That was his stated motivation. But Berlin was not just the philosophical capital of the world. It really was the city to be, and that's where the action was at if you were young, interested in radical ideas and new thinkers, and he wanted to go there. That was really much more interest to him than any classes that he might take. And of course, going to university today, you will learn as much or more from your fellow students as you will from university professors, and the lessons may be very different and much more exciting.
Karl Marx showed early promise in his philosophy studies, and he got his doctorate. And was he able to get a teaching position in academia?
No, he wasn't, in part because he was associated very closely with a group called the Left Hegelians. I'll spare everybody the details, but Hegelian students divided into right and left-wing Hegelians, and they were part of the left. And because they stressed things like change, like progress, this was not regarded well by the Prussian authorities, who, like all governments, like to keep things fairly stable and under their control. So his own mentor was denied a university post, and it was made pretty clear to Marx that even with his doctorate, he was not going to get a university position because of his work on various left newspapers and his left-wing ideas. And so both he and Bakunin turned to the other avenue open for young radicals, which was to work on newspapers. And so both of them are involved with the radical press. They are writing and trying to publish articles in them. Marx becomes an editor and does an awful lot of work with radical newspapers in this period, stemming from not just their philosophical and theoretical interests, but from their understanding of the world around them, that they see and they read about the terrible conditions of workers. Marx wrote very movingly about, years later, saying that he'd studied the law, but it was all about great principles and about constitutions and justice. And when he read newspapers and investigated the stories of Silesian weavers who were, attacked by the Prussian armed forces, realized that all the beautiful language of the law disguised how it really worked as a way to oppress the working class. So for him, this coincided nicely with what he had taken from Hegel, but it made it clear to him that those political struggles had very little to do with grandiose philosophy. And Bakunin, at the very same time, was coming to that same realization. I think it's in 1842 that he publishes a piece where his very famous quote comes from. The quote is, "The passion for destruction is a creative passion." And all kinds of people have used that as some people have used it, I think, as their entire guide to tactics, not always with great results, but he was writing very much as a kind of political Hegelian, not someone talking about destruction in that physical sense, but the need to overturn the institutions and overturn the world that people knew. And Marx came to very similar conclusions, and the two of them are even using very similar language at this point.
And where did these two men stand in terms of these labels that we now use, socialism and anarchism? I mean, I'm curious whether Bakunin was an anarchist at the time, say, that this first article in the journal he wrote was published. And where was Marx at the time?
Yeah, the two of them were both, I think, better described as radical Democrats than as anarchists or as communists. Marx, in fact, writes a great length about why communism is wrong. It'll never work. It's not going to be possible. And Bakunin was a very different, I think, writer and thinker than Marx. What Bakunin had a talent for was looking at the big picture and expressing it in vivid and powerful and moving language. Marx did that sometimes, but you don't find that in every chapter in Capital as you go through it. And neither of them would have described themselves as being communists or socialists, that what they fought for in their newspapers and later on in the streets, in the case of Bakunin, was for something that we might think of as a radical democracy, that everyone would have access to the state and that the state would then make laws that would make sure that workers received a fair pay and worked under better conditions.
And so if we can continue along the two men's trajectories. In fact, by 1844, both Bakunin and Marx were in Paris. And I'm just going to say how I understand their situation, because I kind of want to push things forward a little bit. But the journal that Karl Marx was editing or helping to edit in Germany was shut down for political reasons. Bakunin was convicted in absentia for criticizing Russia's government. They both go to Paris. They meet there. They travel in some of the same circles. They hang out with some of the same people. There's a lot to be said about that, and people certainly can pick up Mark Lear's pamphlet and read about it. But I want to push forward to 1848, which is the year of revolution throughout Europe. And I'm wondering what happened to Bakunin. Where did he go and what did he do?
Yeah. Well, Bakunin fought on the barricades across Europe in this period. He was in Prague. He was expelled, goes back to Leipzig to plan to keep on fighting, and finally ends up in Dresden. Because this is, of course, the year in which revolution breaks out across Europe. And Bakunin is the first real street fighting man. He is, it pops up all over the place. Frederick Engels notes later that Bakunin, is the figure of this street fighting activism. He, at one point, he's actually, and when he's in Dresden, is on the barricades beside Richard Wagner, the opera composer. Marx, on the other hand, leaves Europe. He finally gets over to England. This is one of the points in which the anarchists and the Marxists fight about each other. The anarchists are quick to say, when the going got tough, Marx, lit out and hit it off to London. I think that's unfair. One of the points I really want to make in the pamphlet is that it takes all kinds of people and talents and skills to build a left-wing movement. And the people who do the writing and thinking that work is as valuable as those who do the fighting at the barricades. And I think that's true in 1848. And I think it's a mistake to simply say, Marx should have stayed and fought it out. That would have been the right thing to do. I think these questions are much more complicated than that. But one of the things it does mean is that Bakunin is captured finally. He is arrested. He is sentenced to a long prison sentence and is then handed over to the Russians. As you noted earlier, he had already been convicted in absentia for speaking out against the Tsar, and the Prussians, trying to suck up to the Tsar, hand him over. And he then spends many years in the Russian prison, some of the same cells that they locked up all kinds of radicals and rebels, including, I think, Dostoevsky and Peter Kropotkin.
That's the voice of Mark Lear. That's L-E-I-E-R. He's a professor in the Department of History at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada. And he's author of a new pamphlet put out by PM Press. It's called Divide and Conquer, or Divide and Subdivide, How Not to Refight the First International. And we'll take a short break and return and speak more with Mark about Marx and Bakunin and the extraordinary drama of their feud and also their temperaments, because what Mark is very interested in is kind of how these two men reacted in an emotional way, what their inclinations were, and how that might have fueled their dislike for each other. And, maybe things could have been different if these two men had different temperaments. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Mark Lear is my guest. He teaches history at Simon Fraser University. And we are talking about a pamphlet he wrote called Divide and Conquer, or Divide and Subdivide. And it's about Karl Marx and Mikhail, or Michael Bakunin, and their similarities and differences, and the feud that resulted in the breakup of the First International in 1872. And Mark has written a biography of Bakunin called Bakunin, The Creative Passion. So Bakunin ends up in prison in Russia, very hard life. He's then exiled to Siberia. He meets a woman. What, you know, and really we're talking about somebody who became the sort of one of the real icons of the anarchist tradition. And anarchism, many people will know, has a that way of thinking features a strong distrust of the state and of hierarchy and of authority. I'm wondering what Bakunin's treatment at the hands of Russian authorities, what that might have to do with Bakunin's eventual strong, severe dislike of authority.
I think that spending several years in prison, many of them in solitary confinement, losing your teeth, all of your teeth to scurvy, probably gives you a deep antipathy towards the state and probably stronger than Marx. Now, Marx had no illusion about the state. He understood it, as he put it in the Communist Manifesto, as the executive committee for managing the affairs of the bourgeoisie. But his own work was more dedicated to understanding how capitalism works and how we are exploited and dominated by that economic system. Bakunin agreed with Marx, agreed to that socialist propositions, but time and again comes back to the state as the primary force of domination. We can go back and forth and argue about, you know, which is more primary. One historian concluded they were both co-primary, which is not very helpful as a way of putting it, you know. But I do think that his own experience at the hands of the state made him a more bitter and forceful and articulate opponent of it than Marx would be. Marx, of course, is in England at this point. And one of the things that he sees is some room for reform through parliament, through voting, through political activity. So in that sense, I think it's plausible and useful to see that he actually has a different attitude about the possibilities of the state, not about its ultimate power, not about the fact that it is a tool that is used primarily by the capitalist class, but he does see more potential for incremental reform in the short term than I think Bakunin did. Bakunin finally manages to escape Siberia. Now, it is the case that when he's in Siberia, he is not working in a gulag. He is working as a merchant's agent. He gets to travel some bit around Siberia. He does meet someone and they marry. But it is still his time in Siberia does mean that he is in exile, and he works hard to escape, and he engages in a very long journey. He leaves Irkutsk, jumps on a steamer, barely escapes getting caught. Someone had said, if the wireless connection at the port had been done a month earlier than it actually was, the authorities could have nabbed him. Makes his way to Japan, then to San Francisco, where he takes a ship through the Panama Isthmus, crosses overland, ends up in New York, finally gets to London. And at that point, he and Marx meet up again, and they seem to get along pretty well. And Marx somewhere reflects that, on the whole, I think, Bakunin's much more interesting than he was several years ago, unlike most of the people that I know. So there was this moment, I think, where they could have got along. And Bakunin himself says to Marx that, before I may have been a radical Democrat and someone keenly interested in questions of national liberation, especially that of the Slavs, what I see now so clearly is that we must fight against this capitalism, that really is the enemy. It's not about just overthrowing a government, replacing it with another one based on nationality. It's not about Slavic independence, but about fighting against capitalism. So there is this moment where the two of them come together, they seem to get along, and it was too bad the story didn't stop there. Because I think that the two of them brought so much that is so important to the left-wing movement together. And that really is one of the points that I wanted to make in the pamphlet, which is it does take all kinds of talents and skills and even personality types to make a movement. And this is an idea that I've taken not from psychohistory that I'm deeply suspicious of, but from the work of of activists and organizers, in particular one named George Lakey, who has developed a training tool along with other people that suggests that we bring our personalities into organizations and we adopt social roles based on these personalities. And to sketch it very quickly, you might see yourself as someone who's primarily a helper. You know, maybe you're the guy with the first aid kit in your car and you're the first one to pull over if there's an accident and try to do something. Other people see themselves as rebels. They're the ones that say, simple protest is not enough. We have to really take it to the authorities, and we need to be loud, and we need to be disruptive. Others might be organizers. They might be educators. We play different roles in the movements. And people, I think, may be able to look at moments where they have been in organizations and they have played these roles, and they will know how quickly the actions of the other groups feels like almost a personal attack. If you're a helper at a demonstration, you know, you're putting a bandage on some people, and all of a sudden the rebels start breaking windows and now you're getting tear gassed, and your reaction is the rebels are not helping this situation, they're making it worse. Rebels, of course, are quick to say that education and talk doesn't mean much, that what counts really is action. Organizers and educators might say, we actually need to think things through. We need to think about tactics, not just that feel important and powerful and empowering to us, but those that will bring other people into the movement. And so people respond very passionately, I think, when their own social role is challenged or threatened or not respected. And it takes real work, I think, to overcome that. And it takes time, which is often a luxury when we are organizing and trying to push back and to fight back.
So using this framework, what roles did Bakunin and Marx play?
I think Bakunin in this framework really is the rebel. He is the one that, you know, would say that even if I don't think we're going to succeed, and he was very much a realist. You know, he would embark on adventures in 1848 and much later, knowing that there was little chance, but believed that it was crucial that action be taken and that people be shown the possibilities and the potential and learn from that. Marx, I think, is very much the educator. His philosophical training shows in virtually everything that he does that it's more important for him to get it right. And Bakunin, I think, would say, you know, the theoretical distinctions, I get them, I like them, but what's most important is that we show the way, that we take action. And I think that both of them then, because they're not able and interested in working together to bring both of these strengths into the movement, this becomes a source of friction and feuding. And it is also the case that most of their fighting in the years of the First International takes place when they're in different cities. They actually never meet again. That this fighting, it's more like flame wars on the internet than or through email than it is reasonable political discussion. They're doing it through proxies. They're doing it through impassioned letters. Their temperaments are flaring. They are engaged not in building a movement, but in trying to attack their opponent within the First International. And so it's always struck me in political groupings and other kinds of organizations that this is often a huge waste of time. It doesn't help us become, you know, better thinkers, better organizers, better rebels. It means that we fight against each other. And I think it's useful then to look at the First International and that feud to draw those lessons out. How do we build organizations where these different and crucial strands are strengthened and brought together?
Mark Lear is my guest. He teaches history at Simon Fraser University. Before he joined the faculty there, he worked as a bridge tender, a short order cook, a busker, a construction laborer, and printer. And the pamphlet has the title Divide and Conquer or Divide and Subdivide, How Not to Refight the First International. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So you have laid out a lot of the similarities, not just in the backgrounds of these two men, Bakunin and Marx, but their ideas and what they thought about authority and what they thought in relation to social justice and the concerns of people who were marginalized, who were exploited. So How do we begin to explain this acrimony? And maybe we could turn to, you write in this pamphlet something about the fact that each man had to establish a kind of brand. I think you referred to this, had to kind of brand their politics. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's maybe a choice I wouldn't have made again if I was rewriting this piece. It gives an awful lot to the corporate world, and I find that pretty despicable at that level to talk about this. But I think it is the case that they are trying to make strong arguments for their side and their particular view. Although, as I've said, when we dissect their views, I'm not so sure there is that much difference. But it is often the case, if I can use the branding example again, that when two companies have similar products, that's when they really have to spend a lot of attention and a lot of energy and money to try to say, you know, Coke is different and better than Pepsi. And my point is not that the politics is a simple commercial proposition, not at all. What I am trying to suggest is that the effort put into distinguishing where they differed, I think, was very disproportionate to the real differences, which were much, much smaller. And that's why I suggest, you know, kind of facetiously, that what they are trying to do is to stake out their turf and give people reason to support them on particular motions that they're fighting through at the First International.
What were the most salient points of disagreement, public disagreement, between Bakunin and Marx at the First International? What issues did they publicly differ over that really assumed prominence?
You know, they had a huge fight over the rights to inheritance, whether they should be abolished, whether they should just be ignored in the short term, you know, and whether this was a huge fundamental point. And the reality, again, is when you look at it very closely, they were pretty much in a agreement. They disagreed about how the International should think about religion. Both of them were atheists. Both of them understood that religion was not just a mistake in people's minds, but was at one level a tool used to manipulate people. But for the people themselves, it was a way to try to mitigate the pain and the terrible conditions of life on Earth. Again, it's not much of a difference when you get right down to it. But neither was prepared to read the other's work charitably and to engage in a fruitful conversation. And that's why I suspect that the fights in the First International had much less to do with the issues than they had to do with temperaments and especially their own roles within the First International. It is the case that both sides, you know, later piled on. You know, Bakunin said, you know, that Marx was an authoritarian, that he wanted to run the International with an iron hand. And Marx's response was to say that Bakunin just likes to create schisms and is actually organizing his own mini International, his own sect within it, because he wants to control it and dominate it. I don't think either of them particularly wanted to dominate. Both of them had ideas. They wanted to be heard. And then it becomes something different. It does become something more personal, I think. These guys are bursting into flames over what they believe are calculated insults when they were simply sometimes misstatements. They build up charges against each other in the most egregious fashion. It is the case that Marx was an intellectual bully, but that's very different than saying what you want to do is create an authoritarian state that's going to throw people into the prisons of the Cheka, which is kind of, you know, how that argument tends to be expressed today.
You also examine Bakunin and Marx's relationships with two radical thinkers, Wilhelm Weitling and Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. First, tell us who these two gentlemen were and kind of the significance of the different ways in which each of Bakunin and Marx approached them.
Both of them were an earlier generation of European radicals. Weitling was a tailor by trade at a time when tailors, when the industry was being de-skilled, was being replaced by sewing machines and by factory production of clothing. And he was a socialist writer that both men greatly admired. Prudhomme was a French worker, a printer, and journalist. He later does win an elected position. He's sometimes considered to be the father of anarchism. Neither of them had the benefits of university educations that Bakunin and Marx did. And as I've said, Marx was an academic bully and an intellectual snob. And at a meeting of the Communist League that Weitling had helped to found, Marx, working with Engels, denounces Weitling to really push him out of the organization. He embarrasses him at a meeting of the comrades and pounds the table saying ignorance has never helped anyone yet. And this really speaks, I think, to Marx's own perceived role, reflecting his training and his temperament of the educator, that what was important, most important for Marx, was to get it right, to do the analysis. And if you read, Marx at all, much of the Communist Manifesto is his critique of different kinds of socialism. This is their fundamental error that they have made here. And he was very much like that with both Proudhon and with Weitling. And at one point, Marx reads a Proudhon's pamphlet called The Philosophy of Poverty, where he goes into, how he thinks the system works. And Marx writes a very, entertaining but nasty polemic against him called The Poverty of Philosophy. Mm. I think that illustrates Marx's notion that what was important was to get the theory right, to spend the time. And we know he spent years and years in the British Museum writing and rewriting and doing this research to create the several volumes of Capital and works that are still, I think, of critical importance today. Bakunin actually agreed with Marx on the question of Proudhon, thought, that Proudhon had a spirit of justice and a spirit for equality and liberty, which did not extend to women, but that's another topic perhaps for another day. But was happy to overlook that because what he appreciated was that spirit. I agree with Marx. Yep, he doesn't get it right. He's a sloppy Hegelian at best. His political economy is pretty weak. But that's less important than the contributions he has made. Weitling's work, same problems, the same flaws. It's sentimental. It's based only on personal experience in too many places. But for Bakunin, it was more important to respect the work that they did and to be more encompassing. And so, again, this is a difference of personality and what you think is most important to bring to the organization, to bring to the left.
And what about this question, which still bedevils the left, the question of, and it's a fundamental question of reform versus revolution. You were saying that, based in London, where the British state was relatively more liberal than, of course, the Russian autocracy under which Bakunin was suffering, Marx was interested in what reform might do to the working class, to the proletariat in Britain. Is there any substance to, Bakunin saying, look, Marx was too reformist, that he had a kind of patience that was not productive for the left, that the left had to be acting in a more revolutionary kind of way?
Yes and no. That's a typical Canadian kind of response, I guess, to a question. But I think, again, that difference has been really overstated. I mean, later in his life, Bakunin even urges people to run for politics, saying, in times like this, it's important that we get good people elected because the reforms they can do are, in fact, deeply meaningful and important. And Marx did not give up on the idea of revolution. The question of reform versus revolution, I think, is often a false one. That is, why do we have to choose? Why can't we do both, right? The industrial workers of the world took that view. Yes, we organize for better wages right now, but we are also organizing for the eventual general strike in which workers will go on strike, then lock the bosses out and take control of the means of production themselves. So I think it's a false dichotomy that both sides have sometimes used to attack the other. Again, when you look at it, both of them thought, of course, you don't say no to immediate gains. Neither of them subscribe to what's sometimes called the immiseration thesis, that, you know, that we have to push so things become much worse and then people will rebel. Both of them were much too knowledgeable about history and much too careful observers of their own world to think that that was the case.
Mark Lear is his name. We've been talking about a pamphlet that's recently come out from PM Press. It's called Divide and Conquer, or Divide and Subdivide. And it's about Marx and Bakunin and the feud between them and their similarities and their differences and their temperaments, their histories, their backgrounds. Very interesting stuff. You might also be interested to know that Mark has written a biography, a much acclaimed biography about Michael Bakunin called Bakunin, The Creative Passion. And he also teaches history at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada. Mark, thanks so much for writing this and for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much, C.S. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.